good morning, everyone. I believe there may actually be a change in the weather conditions of Cape Town. All around Cape Town, the rain has come, 60% forecast, and it is around Cape Town. It may mean that a greater appeal to the Almighty, as it were, may now clinch a deal or two. On the other hand, if people in the Western Cape forget politics and work together, secondly, the rich and the poor and the unemployed and the unemployed and the employed poor. Because as we learned, we shouldn't wait for those fires which we had last year, terrible fires that saw the wealthy on the beach and finally cheek by jowl on church floors with people from the shacks. We shouldn't wait for that, where they said to me, they were people who they hardly knew and were strangers and whom they banned from their yards. They all became good friends because they had lost homes. Do we need that sort of incident before we get together as a people? And it is an appeal. I'm looking here, and probably no one lives in the Western Cape here, but on the left, it is very... No, I'm not taking a comment on this opening because I happen to know every member in this committee is busy saving water in the villages. I would hope so. So I do want to end that note on that appeal. It really is an appeal to all of you. I'm not going down to the political route at all. Not at all. But we do seem to have forgotten in our country that we are founded on a constitution informed by a Bill of Rights and the struggle, which we all agreed to, but most important, an element called cooperative governance, the only country that has institutionalized that. And it's time we implemented that effectively in our spheres of government and departments and institutions. So thank you for giving me that time to just extend my opening and welcome. I wish to welcome all members here. It's great to see a full complement of the DA, as it were, both brothers in arms, and then the ANC, of course, the stalwarts here, as usual, looking as if some of them are celebrating wedding anniversaries, and... we have the Honourable Mantash, who is, of course, at her young age, somewhat of a veteran. But I'm glad you are here with us. Oh, and at this stage, it was a single man, Buyani, for a long time. And then I noticed Honourable Williams was here when I walked in and had to leave quite urgently, and as a black carrying the red flag. Thank you. Now, the adoption of the agenda requires one minor item change. I've discussed this with the chairperson of the subcommittee on copyright and commonly referred to as CAB. And you see, I said we'll have a full complement. Honourable Tlanguini is here as well. The CAB bill has been off the full committee, this committee table, portfolio committee table, for a while. It has not been buried at all. A lot of work has been done in the back room by the technical team. I'm going to ask Mr. Hermans, who's very au fait with that technical team, to speak to the status report, and then ask the Honourable Tierko to add if there's anything he may have overlooked. Honourable Tierko, you know, a couple of little glitches here and there. So that's the only, that's one. I'm not sure if all of you still note that we're finishing at 1500, because that it was removed from mine before I could issue an official complaint. So I merely note that we're finishing at one without an official written complaint. Thank you. Well, you know, I mean, he gets carried away by my enthusiasm and then adds on 2 hours. You know what it's like. Right, apologies, Mr. Hermans.
Chair, we have an apology from Advocate Albert, who is in Gauteng, work busy with party business. We have not received an apology from Mr. Estes as yet. I'll double-check my emails later. Mr. Gachalia may leave during the course of the meeting, but he will indicate to you when he will be doing that. He will return. There's no other apologies.
I've already noted about apologies that while party business is up to your particular chief whip, it is, or senior whip, or whatever, you know, the political person in charge in your party. It is not considered good governance at all to be allocated to a committee and permanently have party business. That I will not accept. And I said last week I intend to talk to his principals. I know he's carrying a very full load. But there are people sitting here doing the same thing. So I don't want to go down that street, because when he's here, he contributes actively and he's always doing it in writing. It is not sufficient to send your comments in writing. It's not. I want to make that clear. In my first term as chair here of Trade and Industry, I referred these to the elite parachute regiment. The people who parachuted in and out on party business. We may have to look at the parachutists again. I do not want an SS regiment here. Thank you. Now, adoption of the agenda with that amendment. Honourable Tierko, Honourable Mantash, thank you. And I saw Honourable Blanguini and many other hands coming a flying up, wanting me to just get a move on. Right, the update on the processes with respect to the Copyright Amendment Bill. I've already indicated Mr. Hermans will speak to it.
Chair, each member has a copy of the status report, so I won't go word for word through that report. Just to highlight a couple of matters. The committee has identified a number of experts who should serve on the panel, and we were instructed to check their availability. Of the four that committee identified, Ms. Advocate Pather, Advocate Kumeli, Advocate Myberg, and Professor Kajika, only two has indicated their willingness to serve on the panel, and they are Advocate Myberg and Advocate Pather. I also distributed Professor Kajika's reasons for why he will not be willing to serve on the panel, and Advocate Kumeli is indicating that's not her area of expertise, so she would not be she's not willing to serve, or is not available to serve on the matter. The committee also asked the secretary, also identified Risa as a potential panelist. Point 6 indicates what has happened. RISA is an organization within the music industry, and Secretariat approached Advocate Sabisi in this regard. And point 7 explains the rationale for that. What has happened on point 8, he has identified a number of potential panelists that the committee can consider to add to the panel for future. What needs to happen is that the committee needs to look at these names. We will provide the CVs and more details of these candidates for the committee to look at it, and then the committee will have to make a decision if they wish to add to this panel. We only currently have two on the panel, but if they wish to add any additional names to the panel. The process going forward, the committee will resume the deliberations on the copyright amendment bill once it has completed the process with the National Credit Amendment Bill, and that most likely will happen in the second quarter of this calendar year, happening from April onwards. Chair, that's it.
Honourable Tiako, do you wish to add anything as the chairperson of the subcommittee?
Thanks, Chair. I'm happy with the progress so far, and to indicate that with the process, the way they are unfolding, we will meet as a subcommittee and finalize on the matter in question on the RISA. Thereafter, we'll come and present it to the committee for adoption. The other processes, Advocate Van der Merwe is on board, and they are ready. The DTI must come with the policy issue where we need to finalize on that matter so that there's no conflict of interest of we are running away from the policy. And then, so far, I'm happy with the progress. Second quarter, we are ready to table the bill as it is.
Well, I take your hand, Honourable McPherson. Can I check with Mr. Hermans? Just to refresh our memories, who sits on that subcommittee?
I think the chair is Ms. Tcheko. I think Ms. Shlangwini is a member of that, and Mr. Kachalia is a member of that subcommittee representing the Democratic Alliance.
Could I check with her if that's her understanding?
Yes, Chair, that's why we're not concluding anything now. The committee must give an opportunity to the subcommittee to meet first. Then after we have finalized, then we'll present it to the committee. That's how it is, Chair. The committee was appointed by yourself, the committee, so it's there. We need to meet first.
Right. I did indicate that it was either Honourable Mantash or Honourable Van Skalkwyk, I'm not sure, and they would be able to inform me better who would be the second ANC person. I'm not sure who's sitting in debt, you know. Yes, Honourable Munt.
Chairperson, all I know is that I sit in the debt relief bill. Thanks.
Check with yourself, Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
Chairperson, as yet, I haven't yet attended any of the subcommittee meetings.
I think we earmarked you elsewhere, but Honourable Buyani, at the time that we were busy, I think you were still a little bit in and out medically at that time, and you've shown a real interest in putting your best foot and leg forward. So, and I do say that not facetiously, having now had a similar experience. So I know just how painful it all is. You can liaise directly with the Honourable Tiako. All right. Thank you. On that note, we can leave the care. Oh, yes, sorry, I did say I'd take your hand, Honourable McPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I think that this letter from Professor Kajerka is a very, very interesting letter, and one that should be read by all members. And I associate myself with the concerns that he raises in the letter, particularly around the department's handling and drafting of the original legislation. And he asks some very important questions, like what corrective measures have been taken who has been held ultimately responsible for it. But he also raises some very serious concerns about the manner in which, we are embarking on this process when, you know, all we are trying to do is legislate what he believes is in fact flawed policy, because we know that legislation emanates from policy. I really think that it's a sobering account of where we are and what awaits this committee, unless, very serious corrective, actions are taken. And I'd really encourage the subcommittee to actually look at the contents of what the professor has raised and actually develop a formal response, because I think it's important that well-constructed letters like this are actually responded to, and they aren't just tabled for noting, but there is actually an official response from the committee to address the professor's concerns.
Recall, I know, because you have been were in attendance frequently at that point, that the committee as a whole took that decision, and actually, following on that decision, it had to be recrafted, because we did hear what he had to say, not only in the public hearings, but on other platforms. And we took it so seriously that a letter was written to the minister, I think, if you will recall, Ms. Naidu, in this regard, pointing this out, that this cannot go on. And the minister has taken, you called it corrective, he's taken, I think, appropriate intervention, so that we should not be experiencing this again. Time will tell, unfortunately. So I do concur with you that this letter should be read. You know, there's reading and there's studying. Applying your mind. That's what the courts call it. Don't just read and watch YouTube at the same time. That's what most of you do. Leave YouTube off, leave others off. Focus on this letter and the bill. And you should note in the new bill, you know, redrafted, has this now been addressed, these concerns? And be genuine about it. If you, in your opinion, no, then say so. I think that's important. Thank you, Honourable Macpherson. Right, now we can move, and we move with vigour to the presentation by the Black Sash. How long have you been going? I mean, I remember you as a student, you folks, the Black Sashes, as it were. Now, I have asked you if you can stay until 10:30, because I do believe this is when we will conclude, and maybe 10:45, all right? It's an important input. You have always come to issues around the debt. Over the last 8 years, you've done this religiously, and I'm very pleased that you're here to make an input now on what is the, it doesn't say exactly what, of course, that you're coming on, but it is the debt. I know that, but I think in future, let's just note that. So the people concerned, the National Director, Ms. L. Mart, the National Advocacy Manager, Ms. Abrahams Faker, just nod if it's you, because we haven't met, you see. Ms. Peters, paralegal. Janola Dada. And the Dada was easy enough. How do you pronounce your first part of the name?
Tenuala.
No. Right, from Stanford University. So American universities now think they've got something to learn from us. Well done. Good. So over to yourself. Who's making the presentation?
Honourable Chair, it's Huda. I will be making the presentation
right
on behalf of Black Sash. Honourable Chair, honourable members of the committee, good morning. As an introduction to the Black Sash welcomes the opportunity to make submissions on the amendments to the National Credit Act, in other words, debt relief. Our submission is informed by our work with the Department of Social Development and the South African Social Security Agency to stop unlawful deductions, as well as our involvement in court proceedings, education and awareness, and the related community monitoring and advocacy. Working towards the realization of socioeconomic rights with emphasis on social security and protection for the most vulnerable, we welcome the amendments to alleviate the struggles of the indigent. In contextualizing the interest of Black Sash, We submit that the protection of social grants from unlawful deductions is a critical element of the right to social security and assistance as set out in international law in accordance with the South African Constitution as well as in jurisprudence. Providing social assistance also includes providing social protection, which in this instance means protecting and securing the accounts of social grant recipients from unauthorized and unlawful deductions, bearing in mind that there are 17 million grant recipients in South Africa. There is an onus on the state to enact legislation by ensuring the payment of social grants in full, and which is ring-fenced from unlawful deductions through reckless lending. So when you're looking at Black Sash and the National Credit Act, Black Sash acknowledges the objective and purpose of the Act and believes that over-indebtedness is a social and economic challenge that has far-reaching consequence for the most vulnerable social grant recipients. Grant recipients are easy targets for money lenders because they receive guaranteed income from the state. Grant beneficiaries have SASSA bank cards, which are serviced by cash payment services, CPS, who provide the card technology and manage the card program on behalf of the government of South Africa and facilitated through Grindrod Bank. This is important to understand and contextualize how deductions are made. The SASSA contract with CPS facilitated the opening of approximately 11 million SASSA bank accounts by CPS via Grindrod Bank. In June 2015, Grindrod Bank, with Moneyline, a subsidiary of NetOne, opened up the Easy Pay Everywhere bank account, which is known as the Green Card. This EPE card has fueled indebtedness, as many loan sharks use this card to provide loans, often with no affordability test, no proper avenues of recourse, no administrative justice, and no debt counseling. Grant beneficiaries or recipients are trapped in a vicious cycle, using debt to pay debt for food and basic living needs. So the understanding is that with this EPE card, grant recipients are presented with an option to get credit through opening an EPE card, which they do not understand the terms and conditions of that EPE card in terms of credit being granted to them and the payment plan. So over-indebtedness is a social and economic challenge with far-reaching consequences for vulnerable social grant recipients. They become easy prey as they are receiving this guaranteed monthly income. Grant recipients who have bank accounts that have a debit order facility that can secure loan deductions with easy access to confidential data is placed in a very precarious position, especially when no means tests have been done to see if they can afford the loan. And there are no proper avenues of recourse for them to query that. So the debt intervention criteria in terms of understanding the amendments that have been made is we welcome the threshold of 7,500 rand for debt intervention, and this will cover many grant social grant recipients. Under Section 88A(1)(b), realizable assets is too low and the amount should be increased to 25,000 rand. Household assets often exceed the 10,000 limit because of the assets that they have acquired over time. Under realizable assets, under Section 88, where it refers, does not include a RDP house or property provided by government. The elderly, the disabled, women and children need the protection of a secure home. Section 88A(2) makes provision for one application for debt intervention. We are of the view that this should be amended to be at least two, given that small crises may increase the vulnerability of the poor and may force them to apply for debt intervention again. Looking at the evaluation of the application for debt intervention in terms of Section 88B, the prescribed forms and procedure must be user-friendly and easy to understand, with clear guidelines and a step-by-step process. The current application procedure excludes the option to appeal a negative outcome, and we think this is an important aspect to insert for applicants. The amendments which allow for debt counselling under Section 88B, orders for financial literacy or budgeting skills program under Section 88C must be clarified that it is free of charge. When you are looking at the limiting conditions to apply for intervention in terms of the amendments under Section 88A2, it limits the amount of unsecured debt to 50,000, and 3A sets out which types of unsecured debt do not qualify for debt intervention. When children become 18 years, they no longer qualify for the child support grant. They are reliant on bursaries and loans to fund their tertiary education, including accommodation and food. The likelihood of securing employment immediately after completing their studies is highly unlikely given the current economic situation. It is therefore submitted that the limitation should not exclude educational loans as contemplated in Section 10A of the Act. The threshold level for unsecured debt under Section 88A2 should be increased to at least 100,000 Rand to make consideration for education. In the context of orders relating to debt intervention, we commend you on the simplicity of having a single member of a tribunal consider the application for the sake of accessibility and expediency. However, bias and partiality of a single member may result in negative outcome and must allow for a right of review and appeal process. Section 88C, making provision for the extinguishment of the debt, is commendable. Section 88C, paragraph 7, refers to the time period limiting an applicant from applying for credit for 36 months. We shall submit that this be reduced to 24 months. The effect of debt intervention under Section 88D. The right of the tribunal to rescind or change an order where the applicant has not complied with the order may only be made after investigating the reasons for non-compliance. If the applicant acted in good faith and circumstances beyond his control, then those circumstances.
That is slide 12, all right? The reference to 36 months.
Okay, let me just move on. My apologies. The right of the tribunal to rescind or change an order where the applicant has not complied may only be made after investigating the reasons for non-compliance. So if the applicant acted in good faith and circumstances were beyond his or her control, it should not be rescinded. In conclusion, making provision to accommodate those who are grant recipients to be considered as a vulnerable group for unsecured debt should be noted. The application process for debt intervention must be simplified to be user-friendly with prescribed forms. Madam Chair, I'm finished.
You have completed. Do your colleagues wish to add?
No.
You have done justice to the presentation. Thank you. Members, given that this is such an important issue, let's allow some leeway, not for preambles, Honourable Williams, Honourable Tierko, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Montash, Honourable Flanguini. Honourable Tierko, did you have another issue?
I wanted her to explain on slide 8 on that.
All listed, aren't you?
Yes.
One? Right.
On the application on slide 8, 88.8, to say elaborate
Honourable
more on
Honourable Tiercote, Williams is first, and then you can take it in your point. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I just want to welcome the input by Black Sash. I just have a question around what you think should happen with beneficiaries of this grant system. Because you're saying that the, once they get the card, then the loan sharks or whoever rush in and offer them money, and then they take the money because they don't know what's happening there. Are you suggesting that they don't have access to credit at all? And what would you say is the way around the issues that you raised about that process? Thank you.
No, you. The system here is, let us hear the questions, make your notes, and then you'll be given the opportunity to respond. Right, we then had the Honourable Tiako.
Chair, thanks. We thank for the presentation. There's progress there. Slide 8, the last bulletin, when we speak about the application of 2, can you elaborate more on that one so that I understand clearly what is it that you tried to explain to us? Page 8. This is page 8, where you say not one or at least 2 on the application.
Right. Hello, members. You know, allow me to chair. Thank you. Thank you. Right. The next person, I think, was at that moment... Was it yourself? I'm looking at you, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming to Parliament today. And I think at the outset, I think you make some very valuable points in the opening slides. But I think that really speaks to the issue of reckless lending and not so much necessarily debt intervention or debt relief. And it's one of the big concerns that I've had leading up to this bill is that there's a lot of things that are going on around unscrupulous lending, but the bill doesn't actually speak to that. And that was one of the reasons why we developed the bill, to actually look into that. And I think that your points are well made. But sadly, the bill actually just doesn't speak to any of those concerns that you have. So hopefully, in seeing these, the committee will seriously consider how to deal with those specific aspects. But I want to just understand from you with regard to the limiting conditions on page 10. Where you say that unsecured amounts should not exclude educational loans if they are under 100,000 rand. I think that one of the big concerns that I have about including educational loans is that every time someone doesn't pay an educational loan back, whether it's from an ASFIS or a private institution, means that another person is not going to be able to access funding for higher education. Do you not share that similar belief that if people, write those loans off, specifically from government-funded schemes, that it actually lowers the total pool available for funding in the future? I want to agree with you on page 11, and it is a point that I have made, that I am concerned with the single member considering the application, so I think that is a great point, and hopefully the committee can take that on board. On page 12, section 88C7, what is your rationale or view about reducing the limiting period from 36 months to 24 months? One of my big concerns is what we don't want to do is go down this process where we people qualify for debt relief or debt intervention, go through the rehabilitation process only to get themselves back into that time, in a very short period. And we thought as a committee that 36 months allows for some form of a, what I'd call a cooling off period from credit or access to credit, and allows for that that education to take place. So I'd just like to get your thoughts on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Mantash, followed by the Honourable Langwini, followed by the Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I am covered on by other speakers before me, but I just want to check with the presenter, why does he think there should be more than one chances for one to apply for debt relief? Because we are not trying to encourage people to go deep into debt, but we're trying to rescue those people who find themselves already in that boat. So I'm not sure if your proposal does not defeat what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mantash. Honourable Flanguini.
Thanks, Chair. I'm also partly covered by some of my colleagues, especially the one Honourable Mantash I've just raised. Chair, and then I just like to welcome the inputs of the Black Sash, valuable inputs, Chair, that we need to look at. And then on page 10, when I was looking at the educational loans part, and I was thinking back to what President Zuma was saying, this is the year of free education, so maybe perhaps we don't even need to put it in at some point if it will come to that, but nevertheless. On page 6, and I want to divert a little bit, Chair, and if you allow me, because I just like to understand from the Black Sash side, maybe perhaps they've done studies like that, and do you think the grants that we are giving currently, whether it being child support or whichever grant, are sufficient to sustain those family livelihoods, and why people go into debt, if you have maybe perhaps had made studies available like that? If you don't have the answer now, you can just refer me to the study and I can maybe go and read up on it or something like that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Flanguini. Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to welcome the presentation has been made. On page 5, you're mentioning that since this green card came into effect, that fueled indebtedness, as many loan sharks use this card to provide loans, often with no affordability checks and no debt counseling. When looking at the current state of affairs, you'll find that the government is promoting that the grant recipients should use their either the post office or the commercial banks to get their grants. So would you envisage that this problem, seeing that majority of the current grant recipients are receiving their money cash, would you envisage that this problem of over indebtedness might increase, or what is your view on this thing? And do you have an alternative proposal in terms of how we can curb this situation? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Flanguini. I'm looking around in case there's anyone else who wants to just come in at this point. No. All right. I do have a couple of points myself. Obviously, we appreciate the presentation. Yes, you know, these, you refer to it as a green card, all right. I suppose let's get going, there's a green card open. The SASA, what concerns me is that your statement here, often on page 5, with no affordability tests. Now, you see, I thought this was a requirement under the National Credit Act anyway. Now, what exempted SASA? You see, it is an existing requirement. And that is very important. So I have just requested the Portfolio Committee Secretary, Mr. Hermans, to please invite SASE here so that we can get a better understanding of this. No proper avenues, no recourse, no admin justice, no debt sort of thing. I would also like to find out from the Black Sash, because of the community, that you know, the vulnerable community you generally deal with, how often does the issue of farm workers come up in this area, number one? Number two, the cards, the SASA cards, and we are going to look at this through another means as well. The use of the SASA card to be automatically signed up for funeral insurance, which is then taken off your card before you even receive your grant. In other words, it's taken off, cut out, and then you get your grant less the funeral, if I can put it that way. Now, I don't know if you've come across this practice. I do have personal experience of it. I'm not a SASA grant, but I have a relative who is. And they get people who are extremely vulnerable as they're coming down those steps. And, you know, it's sign, 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 and you don't have to worry, it's so small. Arguably, it is a small amount. You're paying 150, 180 for a 10,000 rand insurance. The issue is you sign. Your ID's there in your name, but you haven't filled in any other details on this form. No others. And several churches have brought this to my attention. I don't know if you've come across this unfortunate practice, which I want to first confirm, is it in fact a legal practice in the first place before one moves and clarifies the situation that is prevailing with SASA? Because it may not be policy, but someone may be doing it. You know how these things occur. The other issue was around the 36 months or something, yes, which you were asking to be reduced to 24, I think was the... No, is that what you were saying? Right, I hope so. If that is the case, can you please motivate that so that we get a better understanding of your experience with this target group, all right? And the final point here is, for me anyway, is yes, you know, you talk about at the beginning about the realization of socioeconomic rights and a number of other issues, but you have raised an issue which members have raised about orders relating to debt intervention under Section 88C, page 11 and page 18 for the actual thing. However, bias and partiality of a single member may result in a negative outcome and must allow for a right of review and appeal process. But I think your first question you should deal with is the request to show a slide and an explanation sought. Thank you.
Good morning. I want to respond to some of the questions and then Huda will take the rest of the questions if that's in order with you, Chair. Okay. I want to deal with slide number 5, which deals with the EasyPay card. I will also try to answer the Chair's questions related to funeral deductions and all the issues related to the transition to the new payment system. Now, just to say that there currently are 2.3 million people on the EasyPay Everywhere card. Since February 1st, as part of the National Payment plan or the transition, those grant beneficiaries are now considered to be in a private bank account, and that bank account is operated by Grindrod Bank together with Moneyline, one of the NetOne subsidiaries. Now, the question that was asked is whether the post office or commercial banks are also involved in the transition. Yes, the post office is involved, but there are still a lot of outstanding issues related to a service level agreement, the terms and conditions of the bank accounts, that makes that process almost very slow at the current point in time. Now, farm workers, we have just, or are in the process of completing a documentary, which will be flighted shortly on one of the SABC channels, and it deals with indebtedness and also the Easy Pay card in particular in the area of CERS, which is primarily an area of farm workers. And we have followed two beneficiaries in that instance. Mr. Fortuin is the one who had unlawful deductions made of his account for funeral cover. And the other one we follow has been having three loans from different companies coming off that account. One's Moneyline, the other one is XYZ. And we had managed to help her to get the money returned from XYZ that was deducted unlawfully from her account. So there are many entities, in fact, loan sharks, that can access their money through a debit order within this EPE account. And that's why we are making that a focus and why we're speaking about it. It's not that we are saying people should not be given loans. We are clear that the due process must be followed, including the issue of an affordability test to see whether somebody can afford this loan. And secondly, we do have an issue with loans for food, loans for basic daily living. We know that the grant amount is not sufficient. It doesn't always meet the basic. And in this one instance, she had four children, plus she's a single mother, she's a farm worker, farm work is intermittent, etc. So the consequence of then having two or three loans simultaneously diminishes the grant, and then that pattern of indebtedness then continues. And then just around the funeral deductions, the South African Social Assistance Act, Regulation 26A, make provision for deductions of funeral in nature, for funeral policy, not more than 10% of the value of the grant. And an amendment in 2016 to the regulations is very clear that no funeral deductions must be made of children's grants, all the children's grants, and secondly, must also not be made of any temporary grants. In other words, if you are on a temporary disability grant, for example, we had a study done, an actuarial study for one of the court cases, and we found that the funeral deductions from children's grant, when they terminate or exit from the SASSA system at the age of 18, who carries on the funeral payment? So the funeral service providers were actually making quite a lot of money from children being conscripted into a policy. In fact, the actuarial study states that it was not a need for them to have a funeral deduction. So I think that answers some of the questions that were raised.
Honourable McPherson, what is this?
I mean, I just want to say that, I mean...
Is this a follow-up?
Yes.
On a question?
Well, yeah, I mean...
No, but could you please wait? Let them complete, please. You will be the first as a follow-up.
In response to the questions that were asked, the question of whether deduction should be allowed from grants. The idea from Black Sash is that grants, when they are received by the recipient or beneficiary, should be ring-fenced from any deductions. So that if there is a need for a recipient to apply for a grant, they must follow the normal process of making an application where the credit provider can properly assess in terms of affordability whether they qualify. So that's in essence that the grant should be received in full by the recipient. In terms of slide 8 and the question of the application for debt intervention and making one application. The reason for consideration being made for more than one, because of the fact that we are talking about a vulnerable group. So there may be an issue where they, although primarily we wouldn't want them to be end up in a pit of debt, there may be a crisis where they need a small loan. And in those circumstances, they should be allowed where they've gone after the debt intervention application and there have been circumstances which require them to apply for more debt or to apply for a second application, they may have to engage within the process and be given the opportunity. So we're not saying that the intervention must be granted, but the option must be there for an application, subject to obviously certain conditions. Yes.
Chair, just in, to add to here, often, I mean, like, if you look at the grant categories, it's children on the one hand, and then there's a gap, and then there is...
Explain that again.
Okay. If you look at the grant payment system, it starts with children, then it's disability, and then the next piece is old age. There is no... income support grant for people between 18 to 59. And if you have a crisis, maybe you had a death or some difficulty, and sometimes, I mean, as you go through life, you don't know when those crises are going to come. But if you only have this one opportunity and a crisis with your 1,600 at the moment, and later on, 10 years down the line, you might have another difficulty. We would want the opportunity for people to be able to go again if it's allowed by the members.
Is that completed then from the Black Sash?
May I just add a few comments in terms to make sure that I give a full response to the questions that have been asked? In terms of debt applications, ideally you wouldn't want a vulnerable group to be exposed to having to incur debt. But unfortunately, circumstances in our country where we have extreme poverty may end up that people have to apply for debt. And so the debt application, again, the affordability test is important. And ideally, when you're looking at the situation of the indigent, the question of whether the grant should be increased would be yes. The conditions and the amounts that are being paid and the categories of people should be reconsidered, because if they are not they are going out and applying for loans because the grant that they are receiving is not enough. Looking at whether education and our submission that we in education loans should be included, it is in the context of the individual making the application. Looking at whether that would impact on another person to be able to apply for a loan or be granted a loan, we would look at state intervention or government intervention as to the education crisis at the moment, which ties in with the option of free education. But at the moment, that shouldn't be excluded because education is key in uplifting the individual. And in the context of debt, where people are trying to uplift themselves, education should therefore be included in being able to consider paying off loans. I think my colleague Lynette has answered the other questions with respect of the green card, but if there are any further questions then. Thank you.
Right. I think you had the first follow-up, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much. I mean, I think, again, it's important to make the point that, you know, what you are referring to in respect of, you know, the way that, you know, your documentary, and I look forward to seeing it, you know, that clearly there is an individual who does not qualify for, you know, for three types of loans. And that's catered for in legislation, that is reckless lending, and that those loans should be extinguished immediately, and that action should be taken against those lenders, if in fact they are registered with the NCR. The problem is that most of these loan sharks, or mashonisas, as they may be referred to, are not registered with the NCR. And so there's very little action that can be taken against them. Now, I would argue, and what I've argued, and hopefully you would support this point, is that we simply cannot wait for reform of the NCA in a larger context to take place, because these activities continue to take place regardless, with very little action from the authorities. Now, I'm told that there is an amendment bill to the NCA which is going to deal with that. But who knows when that might be, because every day that it doesn't get done, more and more people fall victim to that. So I do hope that you would support that point and make that clear to the committee, that in fact it is something that we have to deal with now, and we cannot deal with it in isolation and just look at debt forgiveness on its own.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Flanguini.
Thanks, Chair. And I do support your proposal that you have made earlier on to call SASSA for some of the explanations that we may need and stuff. So, but I want to check with you also, Chair, because we're going to call SASSA. There's also some other, that is mainly administrative things that, you know, that we don't run the same thing, and, you know, because other committees are also dealing with it, and there's an inquiry running as well, so but I would support them to come and to answer. And then on the second one, Chair, I was just looking, and when the lady was explaining about the one person or the two persons that they are assisting, and there are 2 million that are on that card, and how many of those 2 million fall prey to this reckless lending, and how can we assist it? Where does NCR come into to play and to assist with it, with the ones that are registered, that one can pick up, you know, what are they doing in terms of that, besides the one that you obviously that are, you know, your machonisa that you can't, like, pick up, but the ones that are registered, what is being done about those ones? Are we just leaving them because we are too scared to take these big corporates on, or what is happening? So I would like to get that specific answer, maybe perhaps from the NCR per se, to what are they doing in this instance. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you so much. Just on your support, but also your clarification. We wouldn't want to overstep our mandate. However, this is specifically the debt issue. And so specifically in this respect, we're not doing the huge inquiry on X, but they need to come here and explain, and anyone involved. Thank you, Honourable Flanguini. Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add on that one. I think the company that's also giving loans, it's not SASSA actually, but CPS that's making giving the loans to the grant recipients. So maybe we should call them also in to find out if they are doing that affordability checks and all that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. It is very, very important we nail it, you know, because I'm sure it's not a Gauteng issue only, or a Western Cape or a Northeastern Cape and one thing. It's not Northern Cape. I'm sure it's pretty rife, as you said, Honourable Tlanguini, about what is it, 2 million? Yeah, 2 to 3 million, huh?
2.3 million.
2.3 million, right. And, you know, we need to get down to the issue. We know it's not the policy. And, yes, perhaps it's individuals within that department who may be exploiting this issue, you see. Let's just clarify that. So we will be doing that specifically, not going into the whole inquiry. Thank you very much. So there is one last issue I would have liked to ask, and if you have responded, and I perhaps was not applying my mind, this issue you refer to, I just forget the slide, on we spoke about 10,000 for basic household furniture. Am I right? Believe you me, that was a step up from the Magistrates Act or some sheriff thing of 2.5, which was a long time ago. And we separated. Yes, it's household. Then we separated working tools, you know. So it wasn't just that you were allowed 10, you're allowed 10 for this, 10 for that. But you could perhaps spell that out a bit. What does come to more than 10? I mean, my own bed is not that amount. But anyway, do carry on.
The reason why we moved the figure up was often if you look at the elderly, there are about 3.3 million elderly people on the grant system. And it's particularly with that category, people who have worked for many, many years to get a fridge, a stove. They've paid off many, many debts. And hence, we thought that for the dignity of the elderly, that that be considered as a higher figure.
There were many follow-ups. So let's get the follow-ups responded to. The follow-up questions and clarifications.
Chair, just in terms of, you said that SASSA should be explaining, but I think perhaps what would also be good is if Grindrod Bank and Moneyline in particular, it's not necessarily CPS because they would say we're just paying grants, but I think that category of people might have to be asked about the practices. And it's a combination of the bank on the one hand and the lending partner and then also other aggregators, other loan sharks that are given access to the debit order system. That's still the...
saying when you say loan sharks, are you saying unregistered lenders are on the system?
Because
if you are saying that, that's a very serious allegation.
Well, what we are saying is that there is a plethora of people who give loans via the EPE debit order system. We don't know whether some of them are registered or not. So that's why I'm phrasing it in a manner of the EasyPay Everywhere account that facilitates debit order deductions for loans. Some of them might be secured and others might not be registered because it's quite a lengthy process to try and uncover all of that. But what we can see on the ground from the people who are experiencing the deductions, that sometimes they have difficulty, in fact, finding the details. Okay, so that was on that one. With regards to the reform of the, was it the NCA? Certainly when those documents become available, we will study them carefully and certainly provide some response to them. We first want to see them and see what we're committing to.
Thank you very much, but just remain in your seats for a moment. You see, just as well, yes, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. It's just a follow-up on the SASSA issue, that we invite the correct people to this committee. Perhaps Black Sash could give the Secretary a list of who they think are the correct people, because we don't want to end up with a situation where everybody comes here and said, no, it's not us, it's the other one, it's the other one. We want that other one to be in front of us. Thank you.
No, I think that aspect is going to be fine-tuned by staff and also Manco. Thank you very much. But before you leave, just stay there a moment. I wanted us to get on with the work, and I took the liberty of not welcoming the senior members of the Department of Trade and Industry, and that is, and of course the National Credit Regulator and the National Consumer Tribunal. Mr. Nietzsche Tenzi, Acting DDG, CCRD. Thank you. And then we have Mr. Kumkani, Acting Chief Director, CCRD. So that members and everyone can see who you are, you know, they're not as familiar with you as I am. Professor Maseko, the chairperson of the National Consumer Tribunal. We also have Mr. Lasiba, Ms. Machigari, the Chief Executive Officer of the National Credit Regulator. Mr. Lasibi Mashapa, Company Secretary. I saw him here, yes. There we are. And then we have Mr. Tupang Ngubeni, Miss, Senior Legal Advisor. Right. Then we have for National Treasury, somebody who has really, you know, committed herself to this process, among all her other commitments. And I say that not facetiously. I am well aware of how stretched you are. So when I say thank you for being here again, Miss Gibson, I do mean it. Senior Advisor. Then we have Miss Nkondela, Director, National Treasury. Then Miss Mamburu, Senior Economist. Yes, there we are, waving around there. And as I said, we've acknowledged the Black Sash, I understand, have we not, your whole team. Then we're going to have coming up to the podium, and while I'll carry on with who's here from the committee support, we're going to be getting the presentation by the Department of Justice. And I want to reiterate my appreciation to this department and ministry for the speedy intervention in legislation that they undertook when they knew that this was a challenge. Didn't wait, it's this problem, that problem, and I don't know how many others, you know, we can always dredge up problems. And I really appreciate your prompt response in dealing with these outstanding challenges. The Department of Justice, we're going to be having a Ms. Pillay, the DDG, Legislative Development here, thank you very much. And of course the same team. What I should note, the committee secretary is saying, not secretary, but portfolio committee secretary, is the 80-20 I think one would be meeting them for the first time. A process, but yeah, they're not sort of frequent flyers. Right, Miss Meltzer there at the back, Miss Hayworth and Mr. Odendahl, they're under National Treasury, as I understand that team that did the research, 8020. But we will come to you. Thank you. We're now going to be with the department. You may now. Yes, Miss Pillay, as you see, is there, and you're not part of Justice. No. Right. Okay, fine. We really seem to have made good progress, members. I'm very pleased to hear that. At the end, I'll have to just come with a few minor changes to our committee program in the light of what we have been talking about. All right? I'm sure you understand that. Right, Ms. Pillay, over to you. Oh, sorry, I mentioned my own team here. We've got Advocate... Charmaine van der Merwe, the senior legal advocate there, especially in the crafting department. I'm sure they don't call it the crafting department. Drafting. Right. And she has had endless late nights and weekends to do some of the work we've been referring to. Thank you. Right. And just for the public record again, it is very important that people understand the difference between framework guidelines that may look like a bill and an actual draft bill. Very important. Thanks. And Ms. Naidu, the parliamentary liaison officer, who's an institutional memory for DTI and Parliament. Over to you, Ms. Pillay.
Good morning, Chair. And honourable members, the Department of Justice provided inputs on the draft bill that was published for comment, and we have provided a substantive written input. Today I will speak to some of the highlights of what we raised in the written input. We were requested to, the purpose of the briefing today is to provide comments in terms of Section 3 of the Superior Courts Act, which 2013, which provides that the minister must be consulted if a bill is to be introduced, which among others amend the structure or functions of a court or tribunal. The comments that we provide are in respect of specific clauses of the bill. The main feature is the introduction of debt intervention. We provide comments on the duties and powers assigned to the National Credit Regulator and the Tribunal. And we again make the point that the capacity of the NCR and the Tribunal will be adapted to deal with consumers who wish to access the debt relief provided by the bill. And throughout the comments that I will be giving you today, you will find that there's a lot of drafting proposals that we make. I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but I'll just gloss over them. But there are some substantive comments as well, which I will go through. The first drafting proposal that we make is that in the preamble, you make reference to specific acts, and we propose that you delete those specific acts because you don't want to be limiting in the bill. Section 3 of the National Credit Act states that the purpose of the Act is to promote and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans and to protect consumers. And we just think that limiting it to a few acts may be detrimental. Clause 4 of Section 15 of the National Credit Act. Section 15 deals with the enforcement functions of the NCR. Paragraphs H, capital A, and H, capital B are inserted as further functions. Paragraph HA should refer to applications for debt intervention and applications for rehabilitation provided for in Section 88E. It is suggested that it is specified that referrals are made to the tribunal. Clause 11, insertion of Section 82, capital A in the National Credit Act. the adding national credit regulator to suspend reckless credit agreements. The clause provides for the report of a suspected reckless credit agreement, the investigation and suspension thereof, and referral to the tribunal. It is suggested that the heading of Section 82A should read, Report, Investigation, and Suspension of Reckless Credit Agreement. Clause 14, addition of Part E in Chapter 4 of the National Credit Act, section, the new Section 88, Capital A, Application for Debt Intervention. Definition of debt intervention applicant includes disabled person, minor heading a household, or woman heading a household. The question arises whether elderly people should not be included as well. Consideration should be given to providing that another person should be able to act on behalf of a minor or may not have legal and contractual capacity to enter into credit agreements or to apply for debt intervention. Section 2.4 of the Protection from Harassment Act 2011 provides that any child or person on behalf of a child may apply to the court for a protection order without the assistance of a parent, guardian, or another person. The same may apply to a disabled person. We are proposing that as a precedent that you may want to look at. The new Section 88A, Application for Debt Intervention, the definition of a realizable asset. If the amount is indicated in an act, that act needs to be amended by Parliament each time the amount is to be adjusted. Consideration should be given to provide that the value of the asset should not exceed the amount determined by the Minister in the Gazette. And Chair, I've noted the point that you made that our Magistrates Court regulations are indeed quite old and that it requires a review. I will take that back to the Department as well. Section 67 of the Magistrates Court Act lists the property which may not be attached and sold in execution. Paragraph G refers to arms and ammunition that a debtor is required by law. By law, regulation, or disciplinary order to have in his possession as part of his equipment. Paragraph F lists separately books, professional books, instruments, necessarily used by the debtor in his profession. It is noted that no reference is made to arms and ammunition in paragraph 2 under the definition. And we just raise a question whether it is intended that the arms and ammunition used be included in the instruments necessarily used by that debt intervention applicant. The new Section 88, I'm continuing with those that paragraph. Earlier comments suggested that a definition of a once-off debt relief, as it was then called, should be considered. Although debt relief is now referred to as debt intervention, it is again suggested that a definition of debt intervention be considered to announce legal certainty.
Just a minute, please.
Thank you. I'm back on the proposal of saying that a definition of debt intervention be considered to announce legal certainty. Section 88C, which provides for the orders of a tribunal, may make, give an indication of what is meant by debt intervention. Again, we say that the proposal of how you could define a debt intervention is in Section 88C. Section 88A2, care should be taken to avoid unintended consequences if a date in the past is provided for. An accepted principle that legislation should, as far as possible, cater for future events. There should be compelling reasons for retrospective provisions. I'm moving on to Section 88C, orders related to debt intervention. It is not clear from the provisions of Section 88C if a credit provider will be able to state his or her opposition against an application for debt intervention when the matter is heard by the tribunal. Section 88E, which deals with applications for rehabilitation, provides the tribunal must inform each affected credit provider and debt counselor of an application for rehabilitation, but this is not the same for applications for a debt intervention. the new Section 88F death intervention to be prescribed, the minister may make regulations prescribing certain death intervention measures. Measures that have been inserted provide for comprehensive and meaningful consultation processes. The subject matter of what is to be determined by regulation is substantive and far-reaching in nature. The concern is whether these provisions are not open for challenge on the basis that they delegate legislative powers to the executive, which deal with matters which ideally should be left for the legislature. It might be prudent to amend the bill to allow Parliament to approve the regulations before they are promulgated by the minister. Further to that point, Section 88F5C provides that the minister must, before prescribing any debt intervention measures, among others, consult with the National Assembly. If a proposed debt intervention measure falls outside of the specific criteria or a different measure is proposed, the NA must give its permission. A notice of the intended measure must be published in the Gazette for comments, and a report of the comments must be tabled in the National Assembly. Section 55 of the Constitution deals with the powers of the National Assembly. The National Assembly may consider, pass, amend, or reject any legislation before it and may initiate or prepare legislation except money books. The question arises whether the National Assembly can be consulted on intended legislation. Therefore, the recommendation that Parliament be given the power to approve regulations as it happens in other legislation. For example, Section 94 of the Legal Services Act provides that the Minister of Justice and Education Services may make regulations, but they must be approved by Parliament. It is suggested that the heading of Section 88F read, debt intervention measures to be prescribed, to distinguish it from the debt intervention provisions provided for in the foregoing sections. Clause 19, amendment of Section 130 of the National Credit Act. Section 130 of the National Credit Act deals with the debt procedures in a court. The format and wording is somewhat problematic. I'm not going to delve too much into this, where we say if the court determines that. The point that we want to make here is that by the time it reaches this stage in the process, the tribunal has already made an order and the court does not have to determine that an order has been made. And consideration should be given to put the proposed insertion in a separate provision. And I think what we are saying here in simpler terms is that if you say the court must determine that, then the court must have its own inquiry over and above that which the tribunal has already determined. Clause 20, amendment of Section 137 of the National Credit Act. A suggested amendment is indicated on the bill. It is uncertain if the reference to Section 88F is correct. Section 88F deals with debt intervention measures by the minister. Clause 21 of Section 142 of the National Credit Act. Section 142 deals with hearings before the tribunal. In respect of Section 88C, it was pointed out that it is not clear if a credit provider will be able to state his or her opposition against an application for debt intervention when the matter is heard by the tribunal. The same concern is expressed in respect of the insertion of subsection 3A, which provides that the single member of the tribunal may consider an application for debt intervention on the documents included in the referral from the NCR only, without further evidence. Clause 23, insertion of section 157A in the National Credit Act. The heading of the clause should refer to the insertion of sections 157A to 157D and not only to 157A. Proposed amendments to these sections are indicated on the bill and intend to bring the provisions in line with similar provisions in other acts. Section 157A, offences related to debt intervention. It is suggested that the word deliberately in section 157A2 be replaced with intentionally to bring the provision in line with subsection 1 and to ensure legal certainty. Section 157D, offence by a company. Further punitive measures which could be considered against companies are found in Section 11(4) of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act 2013, which provides that a finding by a court that an employer or principal has contravened the sections dealing with offences in the Trafficking in Persons Act serve as a ground for revocation or cancellation of a license or registration of that employer or principal that it requires to conduct the business. The finding is forwarded to the authority that granted the license or registration, which may review and, where necessary, revoke or cancel the license or registration. This is by way of example of comparative legislation that you could consider for the amendments. Clause 24, substitution of Section 161 of the National Credit Act. Section 161 provides for the penalties which may be imposed on a person convicted of an offence in terms of the National Credit Act. Currently, a person who contravenes or fails to comply with an order of the tribunal is liable to a fine or to imprisonment not exceeding 10 years or to both. In any other case, the penalty is a fine or imprisonment not exceeding 12 months or both. The proposed penalty, in our view, appears to be very harsh and not in proportion to the nature of the offences set out in Sections 157A to C. For example, the submission of false information in an application for debt intervention or altering financial circumstances to qualify for debt intervention attracts a penalty of a maximum period of 10 years imprisonment. A person who gives himself or herself out as a credit provider may be sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. In comparison, for example, Section 33(2) of the Legal Practice Act provides that a person other than a legal practitioner who holds himself or herself out as a legal practitioner faces a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 2 years or to both. So that's just by way of an example to show the disproportionality. It is appreciated that punishment should be appropriate and should act as a deterrent to curb an abuse, to curb the abuse of vulnerable people in society and the abuse of financial and court systems. However, the constitutional requirement of proportionality of the sentence to the offence, as also set out in various court judgments, should be taken into account. It is therefore suggested that benchmarking be done to bring the penalties in line with similar provisions in other legislation. That's the end of the presentation, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. Some interesting points made, yes. Some that you have also given a comparison directly of the issues. Let's turn to the committee. Honourable Williams. And I'm looking at the committee members now. And Honourable MacPherson. Right. Honourable Mantash, let's make a start.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to welcome the input. Chairperson, many recommendations were made to the committee or around this bill in this last presentation, and I think that these recommendations should go into the subcommittee so that we can differentiate between what is what can be described as amendments that are administrative in character and ones that are policy amendments. So may I suggest that we take these recommendations to the subcommittee and then come back to this committee? Thank you.
Right, I think that's a good idea. Honourable Mantash? Sorry, Honourable MacPherson, was that your hand I missed?
Yeah, thanks. I just want to agree with your concern around Section 88E in terms of credit providers, you know, being able to, you know, submit their either approval or disagreement. You know, I think that that is one of the fundamental, you know, tenets of law, is being able to, you know, make a representation on something that materially affects yourself. So I'm glad that has been raised. Yeah, that's it for me. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been covered by Honourable Williams' input And just to appreciate the input from the Department of Justice, and we will come back to the committee after we have looked into her proposals. Thank you.
There's a point I'd like to make. The Black Sash earlier on was also making a reference to the elderly. They also made a reference to the gap between 18 and, is it 59? And I wondered if you had any comments in there. You have pointed to the elderly, fair enough. The other point here about the realizable asset, etc., and you know, you point out about the Magistrates Courts Act. You haven't numbered, and I would appeal to all presenters, please number your slides. It does, it is helpful. But the one about debt intervention continued and the realizable asset, and a reference, and this did come up with us, some members will recall, the arms and ammunition, etc., and other issues, and we noted this because fortunately the Department of Justice had made a presentation to us earlier. And then it is noted that no reference is made to arms and ammunition in paragraph 2 under the definition. Is it intended that arms and ammunition be included in the instruments necessarily used by that debt intervention applicant? I recall there was a lengthy discussion on this, but members may wish to just reiterate the point they made, but we actually, as I recall, consciously decided to exclude that, but it may be necessary as we're making a reference, you know, to the Magistrates Act, etc., that we should clarify that. Can I just get some comment from members there? Because we did look at that. Thank you. William?
Chairperson, with regard to arms and ammunition, we looked at them because of the fact of security, people that work in the security industry. But then we also said that they could be categorized within tools of trade. So that's why we then said that we don't have to specify them. Because if it's, you know, if you're in the security and you have to carry an arm and ammunition, it would fall under tools and trade, the same as a plumber with a wrench. Thank you.
You see, Honourable Williams is the chairperson of that subcommittee. So I'm glad he's explained that for the for yourself, Ms. Pillay, the reasons. The other issues is, you know, the point you make about the tribunal, etc., and, well, first, before that, the future events. Yes, this came up for us. Is this a once-off, or are we going to take cognizance, you know, of that? So that's very constructive that you have put that through. But then again, with the continuation of debt intervention, 88F, etc., you have emphasized the need for the minister to come back, consult the National Assembly. You mean inform them or what? You know what the word consult, it's got so many meanings. Do you just write them a note, this is what we're up to? Or do you take it, is your term here, your phrase, meaning a little bit more than that? And then the second one here is the specific criteria or a different measure is proposed that the NA must give permission, and that clarifies a little what you had intended, and the gazetting, I think no one would disagree with that. But I'm looking at, as I said, that they aren't numbered. Clause 19, amendment of section 130 of the NCA. It deals with the debt procedures in court, etc. Are you with me? And format and wording of a proposed amendment, etc. Seems problematic, 134E. And you quote, in any proceedings contemplated in this section, if the court determines that, the underlined words read, with the proposed insertion of was declared reckless or void by the tribunal, etc., or the tribunal ordered that the debt underlying that credit agreement was extinguished. A comment, it seems problematic. Okay, am I correct? You're on the same page as I am? Now, you go on to clarify that and note that the court does not have to determine that an order has been made. Consideration should be given to put the proposed insertion in a separate, I hope the chairperson, Honourable Williams, you're noting that should be a separate provision. That, to me, is the actual crunch of that particular one. And then the offences. I'd like to ask you, do you find 12 months, not exceeding 12 months or to both, do you find that a sufficient deterrent for those who would proceed to lie and fraudulently make certain claims, etc.? Do you think that is a sufficient deterrent in your own experience in the COJ, a DOJ? Because to me that we did discuss this, how far should we go, etc., and then the same reference again on 2 years, I've said the same thing because I think we noted 10 years after our discussions. So we would like you to just engage with us on that one and put forward some, you know, you've had this direct experience. What has been your experience in this area? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I will deal with the point that you raised about the elderly. I'm not sure what comment you would like me to make, except to say when I came in the presentation.
The elderly, the 18, the gap that, I said you that was noted, but the gap between 18 to 59, which was referred to by the Black Sash. Thank you.
Chair, I didn't quite get the point that they were making, but I can come back to that point at another stage. Let me move on to the provisions of Section 130. I think what we are saying there is, in any proceedings, the way it's worded currently, it says, in any proceedings contemplated in this section, if the court determines that, we are saying that the tribunal has already made an order. So why would you want the court to have to redetermine it? So I think maybe it's just a way of how the meaning is coming across. So you can just consider rephrasing that. The point about offences and penalties. It's very difficult to say what would be a sufficient deterrent. But I think let me start off by our experiences in the department. 12 months imprisonment for providing wrong information, in other words, perjury. You have to look at that offence and you provide for a period of imprisonment, and then you have other offences which also attract a period of imprisonment. So the question is, should perjury actually attract a penalty of imprisonment? When you say 12 months imprisonment, the seriousness of that sentence is carried through by the fact that you could go to prison and you will not qualify for an expungement. You will have a criminal record. So you look at the whole package of it and you say, this, you are going to have this criminal record against your name for quite a while, and therefore that is a sufficient, that lends towards you know, being a deterrent. It's very difficult to say what will stop people from committing these offences, because I'm not an expert on criminology, but I do know that you've got to look at the offence, because you have cases with serious, how would you determine what is a more serious offence, when you take a life or when you put in wrong information on a document? So it's how you would measure that. So I think those are, that's how I would say, I believe it's a sufficient deterrent.
Yes, You see, what worries me, if it was 12 months, I would totally agree. But we all know what 12 months means to someone sentenced. There's, good heavens, I would certainly behave myself in jail if I knew I could get 6 months cut off. Do you know anyone who wouldn't behave themselves? You know, you'd be lucky to have just spent a little bit of a break there, 4 months or something. That's what worries me, because you're always, you do have that opportunity. Do what is required of you and we can review this. And I don't want to change that. I think that's very good. But it does make one want to. And the other thing, which is in reference to many things, you see, this is money that could have gone to someone else. And if you've got 20% of the people doing this who apply, you're holding up that money that should be going elsewhere. So that is a very serious thing to keep it away. The same thing with the education and things like that, where someone was suggesting, you know, look, let's maybe leave education grants out, because, you know, a lot of students are genuine. There's a very genuine problem there, very genuine. But a lot of them, I see them in cars I can't afford. I begin to wonder what's going on, you see. So we need to make some deterrent there. You're holding up cash here through this. But if it's spelled out very clearly, if you do this, you are actually depriving someone else of these funds. And that is why we need to take it a little bit more serious. But I do agree with you. Is it the same as killing someone? Is it the same case as child abuse of under 12-month-old babies and this sort of thing and trafficking? No, I'm not suggesting it is. But we must provide some deterrent. That's all I think the committee was getting at. But I do think that you've already agreed to commit yourself to come back on the children 18, well, adults 18 to 59. I think you have committed yourself to come back in writing. I think, members, we are satisfied with what we have received so far. Am I right? I'm looking at all members here. Right. And, in fact, the tips you've given us here and the suggestions and proposals are very pertinent. Thank you for spelling it out so clearly, Ms. Pillay. All right? So thank you very much. And before there's a mad dash out the door, may I consult with the committee secretary, please? He is ready. So it is now 10 to 11. Please try and return no later than 10 past, all right? So that we can start on the next part of our program, and that is National Treasury. And remember, with National Treasury, we're also going to be getting this research updated study. You know, the 1880-20, all right? So very important that we have most of you here. I'm sure you'll want to be hearing what has been studied and the findings. Not so. Yes. Anyway, so that's why you've got 10 to 11, and try and get back at 10 past. Thank you. Dean. Meetings, but other members of staff sometimes forget they're in Parliament. Yes, we're back again. You can see a lot is happening at the moment, including in the environment of Parliament. And we did have a meeting scheduled, I think, for 9 o'clock tomorrow, as I recall. Let me just check. Yes, until 1. Until 1. Now, Mr. Hermans was able to get this earlier than me, being here, but they were instructed to inform the chairs and show them this email. That all committee meetings for the morning session of Wednesday the 14th, and that was not to allow us time for some late meetings with our boyfriends or breakfasts, must only commence from 1400 due to the political developments, and clearly that doesn't spell that out. This also serves, may I finish, as a political approval, in other words, instantaneous, of all applications to reschedule these said meetings for 2, because you've been instructed to start at 2. I hope this does not mean an avalanche of apologies from members. And I don't want to hear criticism of how our program changes every 5 minutes. Right, Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I'm just not aware of what political developments you're referring to. I don't really watch the news much, so if you could just assist me what you're referring to. And if I could just get that in writing, it would assist me informing myself of what you're referring to.
Let me put it this way. I know you've been busy with campaigns and one thing and another. I am aware of that. I'm also aware that not everyone watches TV, and you did use the word watch. But a number of people, even when driving, switch the radio on. Others who don't have a radio operate the computer, and as you taught me many things on how to access social pages, you personally took the time and trouble to give me these lessons at a WTO meeting. I appreciate that. I'm well aware of how literate you are, computer literate on the social pages, which should have kept you abreast. So I think that was said more in jest. Wouldn't you think so? Yes, as part of our collegiate and non-parochial atmosphere here. Thank you. Right. Now we have Treasury.
2020.
Yes, 2020.
2020.
You see, you said 2020. I thought you were still instructing me. Right, it's 18. 18.
20.
20. 18. Yeah. 20. Not the 1820 settlers at all. Right. So I would like to invite, in the first place, Miss Gibson, who brought you along, as it were, extending, as we had requested, this invitation to your good selves. And we have already acknowledged you, haven't we? So I'm going to hand over to you, Miss Gibson, and it'll be at your direction that you'll lead the way here. Thank you very much. I'm sure you listened with interest to these presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think the main reason why we're here today is to present the results of the research that has been conducted into what we see as being the proposals introduced by the committee. I think just a couple of points, and this is, yes, I indeed listened to the earlier session with interest, and I think that we just need to make a couple of opening clarifications. The point around unregistered business, I think that is a significant issue which the current proposals will not address. So obviously our assessment does not look into the unregistered business and does not therefore take that into account. We also, now I just wanted to make this point up front so that it's not lost along the way. As Treasury, we do have many specific technical comments, technical and substantive comments. So, for example, there was a contribution made earlier relating to an RDP house and the proposal that not fall part as a realizable asset, and we ourselves had made that recommendation. So just to qualify that, what we've been, in terms of our engagement, going on what we see to be the main policy issues which need to be further unpacked and understood and developed. That is not to say that the specific technical or other elements to the bill should be overlooked, but we think that these more substantive policy issues are the focus, and that's where we've been focusing our attention. And then as we get to distill and confirm exactly what the policy decision is, then we can give the broader supporting inputs and continue on that detail. I think also what's important to recognize is that the research that's been conducted is not a once-off. And what we mean by that is, yes, it will give you an assessment at a certain point in time, but alongside it's been developed as an analytical tool, if we can put it like that, which means that to the extent that the parameters of the specific proposals shift, we're able to then recalibrate quite easily what the outcomes of that would mean. What it also does is means going forward on an ongoing basis, I think that we would be able to make good use of this tool, even in terms of some of the other policy work and assessment. I think we're going to raise some questions around data later on, which is one of the critical lessons, I think, that we've got out of this process. Just to highlight for today, then, there's two presentations. The first presentation is 80-20. We are going to talk through the data analysis and the findings thereof. I think the main finding that you will see is, depending on how we define those parameters of who's in and who's out, as it were, so the impact obviously shifts considerably, and we will have some view on how that is. We will then present afterwards, and our presentation is not so much on the data, but really what the findings actually mean and where we can take this forward from here. So thank you very much. I'm going to hand over then for now to 8020, who's going to take us through the analysis. As I understand, we've got now an hour and a half, is that right? So 8020 will then confine their presentation. We're going to try for 45 minutes. We will then keep ours to about 15 minutes, and that leaves half an hour open for questions and deliberation. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm just going to jump right into the agenda. So just going to start off with a credit market overview, just to put everything in context, then look at an introduction to the research and the methodology that we used, and then the last section, we're just going to look at borrowers who are eligible for debt intervention. There's a lot of data in the slides, so I'm going to try to explain them. I think everyone got a handout, so you will obviously have time to look more carefully at the slides at a later point. So just jumping straight into an overview.
Clarify that. Did you say, I know Mr. Hermans has tried to explain this as well, are you saying that we don't have this? As you said on the slides, it will be. Because I took it that we've got them, yeah.
Yeah, so sorry, everyone's got the slides?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's just a lot to explain on the slides, so I might just pick out a few points. Yeah, everyone should have the slides back. So on slide three, so South Africa, we're quite unique in that the NCR publishes a lot of data on the consumer credit market for us. And this data includes a whole lot of things, including the gross debtors book, arrears status levels, we can see active borrowers, So this slide, we're just looking at the gross debtors book. So what you can see here are the different types of credits at the top, how the NCR categorizes them, and then some pie charts that indicate the value of credit in that category. And then the red segment of that chart is just the value of loans that are 3 months or more in arrears. And you can see from this, from the gross debtors book, from a value perspective, the book is dominated by mortgages, almost 900 billion rand, of which just 3% of that value is 91 days or more in arrears. Some other interesting ones, if you look across, you can see unsecured credits. If you look at that, about 166 billion in outstanding debt, and quite a substantial portion of that is 91 days or more outstanding at 17%. I've got some numbers underneath the pie. So that just shows by number of accounts in thousands, I think, on your printouts. So if you look by number, it's dominated by credit facilities. So that would be your credit cards and your retail accounts. And you can see that there's around 25.4 million credit facilities, of which about 14% are 3 months or more in arrears. Moving on to the next slide, we're just looking at credit active consumers, which is also published by the NCR. So what you can see is the number of credit active consumers has grown significantly since 2008. So here I've just compared the first quarter of 2008 with the third quarter of 2017, and you can see that the number of borrowers increased from 17.1 million borrowers up to 25.1 million borrowers. So that's an increase of about 57% of the population 18 plus in 2008 up to around 67%, so about two-thirds of our population over 18 has access to credit. So the NCR also tells us the arrears status of these consumers. So this is based on their worst performing account. So what I've done here, we've just color-coded the people. The blue is current, gray is 1 to 2 months in arrears, red is 3 months or more in arrears, etc. So this is on their worst performing account. So just to pull out some interesting things on this slide, you can see if we look at the 2017 quarter three, just 49% of credit active consumers were current on all their accounts. This hasn't changed much since 2008. If you look back to 2008, the number of current borrowers was around 45% of the credit active population. If you go to the 3 months or more in arrears, you can see the red, indicated by the red people, you're looking at about 22% of borrowers that have loans that are 3 months or more. Another 11% have adverse listings, and another 6% have a judgment order against them. So there's a lot of borrowers who aren't current on all their accounts.
Chair, just to bring the committee's attention, you will see that a big flavor of this presentation is not just about the overall impact, but really looking at the, I suppose, the health of the credit market for this segment. So what we tried to look at and distill are those people who might be, or those people who are completely fine and they're managing their debt, from those people who are, they might be struggling and they're having to revolve payment. You know, you've heard of liquidity management, but they're actually still got their head above water and they're still doing okay, even if they might be a bit under strain at the moment, from those people who are off the cliff, those people who are not going to be able to come back and rehabilitate under the current scenario. Thank you.
Thanks. So another point on arrears status is also, so what does it mean to be in arrears? And it's not a simple definition because different credit providers have different definitions. So for some credit providers, the full payment needs to be made. And if it's not made, then that borrower is considered to go into arrears. Whereas other credit providers will accept a partial payment and not count that borrower as going into arrears. So when you see the borrowers who are 3 months or more in arrears, some of those borrowers could be making partial payments. So just something to keep in mind going forward. So another thing that the NCR publishes is also data on new loans granted. So here I'm just looking at the number of new loans granted. We've got credit facilities granted on the left and unsecured and short-term credit granted on the right. The lines just indicate loans granted to different income groups. So the light blue line is for the lower income group, 7.5 or less. The dark blue line is borrowers earning between 7.5 and 15, and the red line 15,000 or more. So you can see that there's been a shift in unsecured lending patterns over time. So another point just to remember when looking at the NCR data is all incomes are in nominal terms. So that 7,500 or less bracket hasn't changed since 2008. So if we were to look back to 2008, 7,500 rand back in 2008 is worth about 12,150 rand now. So just to keep that in mind when looking at this data as well. So while the NCR data is really useful, it doesn't give us much flexibility with how we can analyze the market. So that's where credit bureau data comes in. So here we've got a slide showing the number of borrowers. This is from XDS Credit Bureau. We got a snapshot of their data for quarter three 2017. And the first thing you'll notice that our definition of credit active is very different. So in the previous slide, you saw there were about 25.1 million credit active consumers, whereas we find about 18.4 million credit active consumers. So the reason for that discrepancy is because we refine the definition of credit active. So the NCR counts...
Do me a... Please, just slow down.
Sure, sorry.
You've gone so fast, I can't even make notes.
Sure. I will slow down a lot. So you'll see that our number is 18.4 million. So that's the reason for the discrepancy is because the NCR, they count any loan as being active if any activities happened over the past 2 years. So that could have been the loan closing, the loan lapsing, that would still count as active. Whereas we only focus on open loans. So they can't be closed, they can't be lapsed, they can't be surrendered or revoked. And that's why we get this discrepancy. And that's why we end up with 18.4 million credit consumers. So on this chart, we just show the number of borrowers. So again, this is an account. We're looking at borrowers now, and we're looking at the number of borrowers who have these different types of accounts. So you can see that retail apparel dominates. So we've got about 10.5 million borrowers in South Africa that have at least one retail apparel account. The number above it, that 1.7, that just shows for people with this account, how many do they have on average. So on average, if you've got a retail apparel account, you have 1.7. And you can see unsecured credit, 7.7 million borrowers have open unsecured credit, credit cards, 6.1 million, and then we move on. You can see mortgages further along, 2.3 million borrowers. So just to draw your attention there again, on the gross debtors book, you would have seen, I think it was 1.7 or 1.8 million mortgage accounts, whereas we're getting 2.3 million borrowers. And the reason for that is that obviously you can have more than one borrower on a mortgage. So you see a slightly higher number of borrowers. So we can also look at the arrears status of these borrowers by the different credit accounts. So that's on the next slide. So I should just also make a point again that this is about your worst performing loan. So we're looking at in arrears, if you're 3 months or more in arrears on your worst performing loan. So for example, if you look at the retail apparel, you can see if you fall in that red bucket there, for example, if I had three loans and one of my retail apparel loans was in the arrears, then I would fall into that red bucket. So just to put into context. So looking at it, you can see that a substantial portion of borrowers with retail apparel and unsecured credit are in arrears on at least one of these loans. So 41% of borrowers with retail apparel and 41% of borrowers with unsecured credit have at least one of these accounts in arrears of 3 months or more. If you look down to mortgages, further along there, you can see it's much smaller. Just 4% of borrowers with a mortgage are in arrears on that mortgage. Okay, so moving on to the introduction to the research and the methodology. So note the focus of this research. So it's on the target market for the proposed debt intervention. So we're hoping that this analysis will help the committee refine its questions and deepen its understanding of the data that could be helpful. But we're not presenting solutions. We're just framing the issues. So for this analysis, we got credit bureau data provided by XDS. So they provided us with a snapshot of data for all borrowers in South Africa, and as well as a random sample of 300,000 borrowers. So we got two random samples, one of borrowers with a mortgage and one of borrowers without a mortgage. This was drawn randomly, so we can scale it up to the total population. And the reason for getting those samples is because then we can also access a five-year payment data, which is very useful when you're trying to get an understanding of payment patterns. So the real key challenge with this analysis was assessing borrower incomes accurately. So to do this, 7 banks assisted us, and they, for our sample borrowers, they provided us with their estimates of those borrowers' incomes. So I'll just talk about that process a bit. So what happened is we got 300,000 random borrowers from the Bureau. We sent those hashed ID numbers to the banks, and the banks gave us, for each of those borrowers, they gave us gross income estimates and net income estimates. So sometimes they gave both, sometimes they gave one, but we got as many as we could. And in the end, the banks were able to match about 74% of our sample borrowers. We then did a process of looking at their income estimates, comparing them, looking at them over time, trying to assess of those banks' income estimates, what were the best income estimates we could assign to our sample. And basically we ended up with 74% with an income estimate. For the remaining 26%, we just used the XDS predicted income, because for those people we did not have a bank income estimate. So this process generated what we think is the best available income estimates, but it's not perfect data, and that should just be noted going forward. So slide 12 just shows our distribution of incomes, of borrowers per income.
Let's go back so that you give us an explanation about hashed. I mean, it's obviously not hash breakfast or something.
No.
What are we talking about?
So hashed IDs, just with data privacy, obviously ID numbers are very sensitive. We don't want to share ID numbers. We don't want to know who that borrower is. So a hashing algorithm is just something to hide an ID number. So no one knows. So the borrowers in our random sample are completely anonymous. We don't know who they are. The banks don't know. The bureau sends us them already hashed.
How were the banks able to match the hashed people?
So you can use the same hashing algorithm. So we told them which hashing algorithm to use, and then they did it on their IDs. It was quite a process. But yeah, so basically XDS hashed theirs and told the banks. The banks hashed theirs, and then they matched on that. And then from that, they could give us income estimates. So out of that process, we got about 74% covered. Obviously, it wasn't going to cover everyone because we didn't have all the banks, first of all. And also, especially low-income consumers, grant recipients might not have a bank account, and low-income consumers might not have a bank account, or they might have one, but they're not using it or using it sporadically, in which case we couldn't get an estimate. So for those 26% of borrowers who we couldn't get an estimate, we used the XDS Bureau. They have a predicted income field that they generate on their side, and we used that with our, we augmented our data with that. So basically, after that process, we ended up with a distribution of borrowers. This has been scaled up from our sample, and this is what it looks like. So you can see that there's a lot of borrowers earning $7,500 or less. So we actually find 10.4 million borrowers with an income of $7,500 or less. We found 3.3 million borrowers with income of between 7,500 and 15,000 Rand per month, and 4.8 million borrowers with an income of 15,000 Rand or more. And these are gross income estimates. So, of course, trying to verify these is tricky. And a problem with understanding incomes in South Africa is that there is very little data. What we did try to do, though, is access the tax data on individual taxpayers. So the next slide, slide 13, the chart on the left in the dark blue, we're just looking at the estimates of individual taxpayers for 2017-18. Those income groups are just the ones that are published, and we matched ours to their income groups. And you can see that we're actually finding higher numbers of higher income individuals. And if we assume that all these people with these higher incomes are credit active, then the number at the bottom there just shows the implied number of borrowers who earn less than 5,833 Rand. And you can see that it's actually higher for, it's higher on when we use the tax data than our data. So I think at the end of the day, we can't be, there's no perfect way to know incomes. I think we, using our methodology, we did the best we could, but that should just be noted going forward. Okay, so the last section, I suppose the important one, is looking at borrowers who are eligible for debt intervention. Sure. So just to get to the population of what we estimate is the total number of people who could be eligible for the debt intervention. So we start with a total credit active market. As per our definition, we get 18.4 million borrowers. So then we only want to look at borrowers with open unsecured credit, and that decreases the population down to about 17.8 million borrowers. Then we want to look at only borrowers who have an income of 7,500 or less, and we have about 10.2 million. We then want to look at those who have an outstanding unsecured debt that is less than 50,000, so it goes down to 9.5 million. We then remove borrowers in debt review, so the borrower must not be in debt review, decreases to 9.3 million, and the borrower has no judgment against them, 9.2 million. So it's around 9 million borrowers that we end up with. So for these borrowers, we wanted to look at the loans that they hold. So of those around 9 million borrowers that we find in this segment, we find that they hold around 16 million loans between them. So I think a key thing is that a large portion of these loans are current, are being paid perfectly. So you can see 59% of those loans belonging to this segment of the market are current. Another 12% of loans are 1 to 2 months in arrears, and then that last 29% of loans are 3 months or more in arrears. So that equates to around 4.7 million loans that are 3 months or more in arrears.
Chair, just to comment on this slide, I think it's a particularly important one, because what this is showing is that if we were to simply apply the qualification parameters as they are currently stated, we would be extinguishing debt of that whole pie, which includes the 59% who are actually currently in good standing. So this pie, if we look at it, represents the universe, or all the people who would qualify in terms of they earn less than 7,500 and less than the 50,000. Okay, so everybody in that category is this pie. And what it's saying is that of that category, 59% of those people are currently current with their loans. In other words, they are not in arrears. They are repaying. So if we were to apply strictly the qualification criteria as they are currently crafted in the bill, we would be extinguishing debt for all of those that's green that are currently making their payments, as well as the 12% and the 29% who either have some problems or a lot of problems in terms of making their payments.
So we have about 4.7 million loans where they are 3 months or more in arrears. So just to focus on those loans for a moment, just to say we want to know what are those loans that appear to be struggling.
Yeah.
So this slide looks at those loans specifically. So this, again, is only looking at those loans that are 3 months or more in arrears that belong to that segment of the market, those 9 million people. So here we show the number of loans in the light blue and the value of the outstanding debt on those loans in the dark blue, and we split it out by the different lenders. So if you look at it by number of loans, you can see a substantial portion of those loans that are 3 months or more in arrears are retail apparel accounts. So 2.7 out of the 4 million are retail apparel accounts. The next is unsecured credit from a bank, 0.6 million, and then unsecured credit from another credit provider, 0.5 million. When we look at the debt outstanding, though, you can see that that is actually highest for unsecured credit from a bank. So that's about 6.5 billion, followed by retail apparel accounts, 5.1 billion. So that's sitting in those loans that are 3 months or more in arrears. So now if I just backtrack a little bit and just look at that segment of the market. So just looking at that 9 million, those 9 million people that earn 7,500 or less and have unsecured debt of less than 50,000. So we're just looking at borrowers that fall into that segment. So just some key points to pull out on this slide. Gender-wise, mostly female, so over two-thirds of borrowers in this segment are female. We also found that about a fifth, it was about 19% of borrowers in this segment we estimate are grant recipients. You can see the income, an income distribution in the top right there, and you can see that quite a lot of these borrowers in this segment have incomes actually below $3,500. Moving on to the next slide, we're just again looking at for this segment of the market, how many loans they have in the top left. So most borrowers in this segment actually only have one open account. So 56% have one account only, and then a further 24% have two accounts, and the rest have three or more accounts open. The Presage scores underneath there. So Presage score is generated by XDF, and it's basically a score based on the how risky they think that borrower is. And the lower the score, the higher the risk of the borrower. You can see that the Presage scores for this segment are quite low, mostly very low. So they are viewed as quite high-risk borrowers. Then the chart on the right is probably the most interesting one. That's just looking at what products does this segment hold. So you can see that 62% of borrowers in this segment have a retail apparel account. Around 41% have unsecured credit. So that's unsecured credit from a bank, of which there's about 11% of borrowers. And then a further 30% of borrowers have an unsecured credit from another credit provider. The bubbles next to the chart just shows the proportion of loans in that category that are in arrears of 3 months or more. So you can see for the borrowers that have a retail apparel account, around 43% have at least one of those accounts in arrears of 3 months or more. For unsecured credit from a bank, it's 48%. We do think that there might be some of the bad book from African banks clouding this analysis, so that could be making an impact on that number. So the next chart, we're looking at a segmentation of borrowers. We're looking at borrower arrear status. And
can you just go back to the previous?
Yeah.
Yes. So again, what the point that I'd made up front, which is, I think it's important that we're taking account of those people who are fine versus those people who are under strain versus those that are off the cliff. So you will see that on the slide 19, on the very right where it's under the product penetration, and there are those bubbles on the very right that you can see those that are more than 90 days in arrears. What this is showing is that the higher that percentage, the more under strain, if we can call it, that the borrower pool within that category. So we're seeing that across this, the retail apparel and unsecured credit, of those borrowers, they're the most under strain, if we can call it that. But also interestingly is the debt recovery. And you'll see that that's particularly, even though the penetration, as it were, is low, the proportion of loans in arrears is extremely high. And what's interesting and what should be clarified is that this is not taken as from the initial point that the person had started to default on the loan. This is actually once that loan gets taken over by a debt collector, at that point it then kicks in and it's a new agreement. And even at that new point, they already are showing this very high level of default, which also shows, so it just is going to show again, that picture of when people get into that part, into that debt recovery zone, they're highly unlikely to unscathed.
Just one moment there. As you can see, and you may need to raise your voices because you're speaking also for visitors to Parliament, and the people walking in, better known as members of the Defence Force, are specifically members of the Defence School of Logistics. Now, the issue here before the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry in Parliament is a committee bill which we call colloquially the debt bill, but actually is the amendment to the National Credit Amendment. It's a National Credit Amendment Bill. It is a bill. And it is the first bill that this committee has actually tabled in two terms. A very important bill. And the people who are presenting as we talk, as they sit here, you will hear them, National Treasury. On the one side, we have Miss Gibson, and she's sort of the most senior person here from National Treasury, a lady who has just spoken with Fair. and the other two are from an organization called 8020, who did a study of people in debt who earn less than $7,500 a month and up to a maximum debt of $50,000. Am I correct in that mini summary? So you may not be the ones earning $7,500 a month when you come out of school, but you will have relatives possibly who are in this area. And it's important that you can just hear what is being said, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your stay visiting Parliament. This is the National Assembly. This is actually the old Assembly Chamber. Thank you. Can we proceed, please?
So moving on to slide 20. So this is a segmentation of borrowers looking at their arrears status. So we've
bit louder.
So we've segmented borrowers based on the number of loans they have and how many of these loans are in arrears. So the inner circle on the right, that's borrowers with one loan only. So you can see 56% of borrowers have one loan only. The outer circle on the left, that's borrowers with two or more credit products. So if we focus on that inner circle on the right, that's borrowers with only one open loan. So if you've only got one open loan, that loan is either current or it's in arrears, 3 months or more in arrears. So that's why that part of the pie is only split into green and red. So if we look at those borrowers that only have one account, you can see 63% are current on that one account and 37% are in arrears of 3 months or more on that one account. So it gets a bit more complicated when you look at the segment of the pie on the left, which is borrowers with two or more accounts, because obviously now you can have some accounts in arrears and some accounts that are current, and that's what this chart is trying to show. So if you look at the green portion of that outer circle, you can see 54% of borrowers with two or more credit products are current on all of their credit products. If you look on the other end of that that outer circle on the right, you can see 16% in red. So that's 16% of borrowers with two or more accounts that have all of them in arrears. All of them. So it's two or more. All of them in arrears. Yeah, so that red 16%, that means that they've got all of those accounts in arrears. But then you've got these segments in the middle, so the light green and the orange. So those are borrowers who are in arrears on some of their loans and are current on others. So the light green just indicates that they're in arrears on half or less, and the orange on more than half. So what's interesting about those borrowers is that while they aren't paying some arrears, some loans, others are getting paid. Another point to make, just that I raised earlier, is that even if borrowers are 3 months or more in arrears, so those borrowers who fit into those red buckets, they could be making partial payments. So some borrowers might actually be paying 50 to 60% of their payments, but they're still counted as being in arrears. So we did try to assess this in the Bureau data, but unfortunately that indicator is not very reliable. So we couldn't determine how many of those borrowers are actually making some payments.
Again, just to add in terms of how we would be looking or thinking about this slide in terms of our policy interventions or our regulatory interventions, is that where we already have, for example, debt review, a process which manages repayments and helps people get themselves to rehabilitate, that we must be thinking around for this entire pool of people, what is the best mechanism to help someone rehabilitate? So there is the question around, do we want to help those people who are already actually in good standing? Do we want to be helping, well, and how? And what about those people who are behind but making some payments? Are there existing mechanisms like debt review, which would be helping or which could be used or leveraged in order to help these people manage their payments better, versus is there a category of person or category of people within this
class who actually, even with the existing mechanisms, we can't repackage their loans, reorganize their loans to rehabilitate them because they are struggling that much.
So slide 21. So just to put this into perspective, using that summary slide that we went through earlier. So starting with our total credit active market, we get down to our borrowers that are eligible for debt intervention around 9 million. Now if we only look at the number of borrowers with loans that are 3 months or more in arrears, so borrowers that have at least one loan that is 3 months or more in arrears, we're looking at about 3.5 million borrowers. That's around, those 3.5 million borrowers hold around 4.4 million loans, and the outstanding balance on those loans is around 19.2 billion. Just a note on that outstanding balance, that excludes debt recovery, which should be in there, so it would be slightly higher than that. And then if we only look at those borrowers that are 3 months or more in arrears, and they're not current on any loans, so all the loans they hold are 3 months or more in arrears, then we're down to around 2.6 million borrowers. And those 2.6 million borrowers hold around 3.3 million loans, and the outstanding balance on those loans is around 14.7 billion rand. So you'll notice that we've been talking a lot about 3 months in arrears because that is kind of an industry standard, but is that the best way to think about it? And another key point on arrears status is that it's not static at all. Borrowers will fall into arrears and then they'll pay back. So you might find borrowers who cycle in and out of arrears. You might find borrowers who will sit in arrears for a while and then recuperate. And other borrowers, once they deteriorate, they'll never come back. So that's very important because we shouldn't just discount loans that are 3 months or more in arrears as never going to get paid. So we try to look into that. I know this slide is very busy. Slide 22. Sure.
Okay, so on this slide, I think this also fairly represents, when I've spoken about the tool that we have available to us to shifting parameters, this slide is shows how those parameters can be shifted. So firstly, what it's doing, as explained, is that it's showing what the different impact would be depending on how wide we cast the net. So if we say you qualify for extinguishing of debt if you earn less than 7,500 and your loans are less than 50,000, which is what we're saying, but we don't ask the question, can you pay or not? We just say if you are in that bucket, that implies 9.2 million people, and it's 50 billion approximately, it translates into about 50 billion in terms of debt. That's a lot. If we then start tweaking that and we say, well, firstly, should it be 7,500 or should it maybe be a lower income, 3,500? We would be able to tweak those parameters. We would then be able to look at what the impact would be. But that's not what we're doing here. What we're doing is focusing on the proposal of the less than 7,500. What we think is important, though, is not to necessarily be looking at a lower income level, but to be looking at the different rehabilitation mechanisms that are currently available. So if we think the extinguishing of debt is just one of those mechanisms, it's the most extreme mechanism. Ahead of that would be rehabilitation through, for example, debt review. Okay. So if we look at the difference between the 9.2 million to the 3.5 to the 2.6 million, that then is applying a different level of, if we can call it, that's giving effect to the principle, if you can pay, you should pay. And so this is reversing it, and it's actually saying, if you can't pay, we need to find a mechanism that you don't have to pay. So we then are applying thresholds of, well, what does it mean that you can't pay? Is it that you are more than three months in arrears? And that would then be your 3.5 million which translates into 4.4 million loans and 19.2 billion debt. So keep in mind, these are proxies. All it's doing is it's saying if we were to apply this principle and we would then apply some indicator of what that how we would give effect to that principle, this is what it would mean. If we then apply a stricter qualification and we then say, well, actually, if you are 3 months, if you've got a loan that's 3 months in arrears, but actually you can still you're making some payments, maybe we can rehabilitate you through a revised and improved debt review system. But we think that there are people who actually can't, they won't be rehabilitated. And then that's then the stricter measure, which then gets you to the 2.6. So that's now 3.3 million loans, and it's 14 billion of outstanding debt. And what you will see is that we're actually going to be applying different lenses as we go through. And we'll be looking at the slide again at the very end to see what the different versions are. Thank you.
Ms. Gibson, what would also help, and thank you for that clarification, is you referred to, well, and you know, those who can do so, if you can't, then what measures, what does this mean? And in other words, what sort of measures should we begin implementing? And you looked at the debt counselling, etc., but if they can't. It would be helpful if you could pose, look, in our opinion, such a question could be quite constructive if it was put to them. You know, so you're not saying this is what the committee should use, but rather, phrased in this way, it may elicit X. So that would be helpful if you could send that back to us, possibly in writing or as soon as possible.
Chair, our presentation that follows does build on this. So it will go hopefully some of the way there, but we then will, I think, request guidance from you in terms of how to take it forward.
Thank you. Continue, please.
Thank you. So just that note on arrears status.
Members, I'm not feeling the heat, but I see some members under pressure here. And someone's got a jacket on, so I don't understand. Are you in the menopause? Okay. Do continue.
Thank you. So we were just saying that when borrowers are in arrears, it's not a static. It's not static at all. People move in and out of arrears. Often people will defer a month, then pay the next month. It happens all the time. Or pay this loan, then pay that loan. So we just wanted to get understanding of that. What's the likelihood of loans recovering once they fall into arrears? So now we move on to this very complicated slide. So just to explain it before I start talking about the charts, what we did is that we wanted to see the probability of loans that are in arrears being able to recover. So we took a date in June 2015, so 2 years ago, and we took the loans in June 2015, I should note that this is for borrowers without a home loan. So we're specifically looking at borrowers with no home loan for this analysis. So we took those borrowers and we said how many loans were in arrears as at June 2015. We took all those loans and then we tracked them over 2 years up to June 2017, and we looked at their arrears status at that point to see what had happened to it. Or if the loan had closed over those 2 years, we checked its arrears status before it was closed. And basically from that, we then categorize these loans into four different segments. If the loan over that time period that was in arrears returned to 0 months in arrears, so completely current, we called it recovered fully. If it improved, so the arrears status decreased, so we called it recovered fully. So those loans that went from any...
Recovered free.
Yes, recovered fully.
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 Yes, you see the importance of, you know, articulating.
Yes, recovered fully. Sorry. So those loans were ones that, for example, they were 3 months in arrears and they went down to 0 months in arrears. Or they were 1 month and they went down to zero. Then we had loans that were segmented into improved. So those loans, the arrears status got better, but it did not return to zero. So, for example, it went from 3 months to 2 months. So there is evidence of rehabilitation, but not back to zero. Then there are loans that just stay the same. So they stick in, say, 3 months over a long period. And then, of course, there are loans that continue to get worse. So they go from 1 to 2 months to 3 months to 4 months, etc. And those are called deteriorated. So if you look at the chart, we just focus on the chart right on the left. So that's loans held by borrowers with an income of $7,500 or less. Along the x-axis, so the numbers at the bottom, that shows how many months they were in arrears in June 2015. So you can see the loans, they were 1 month in arrears, 2 months in arrears, all the way up to 6 months or more in arrears in June 2015. Then the chart above it then shows how we categorize that loan, so what happened to it in the 2 years following. So just to explain one, so if you look at the loans with the little arrow, those are the loans that were 3 months in arrears in June 2015. So of those loans that were 3 months in arrears back then, we see that 23% of them, the dark green portion, those loans recovered fully, so got back to 0 months in arrears by June 2017. A further 11% of them improved, and another 5% remained the same. So you can see of those loans held by borrowers with an income of $7,500 or less that were 3 months or more in arrears, we see more than a third of them either improved or recovered. So the other charts just show that for higher income groups. So we just show, the middle chart shows loans held by borrowers earning between $7,500 and $15,000, and the last chart on the right is showing for borrowers with an income of $15,000 or more. And the reason we put that in is just to show the impact of income. So as borrowers' income increases, their likelihood of being able to improve loans that are in arrears increases.
Did you interrogate or inquire into what assisted this recovery? I mean, did it come out of the blue?
Yeah, good question. Unfortunately, we can't see. We can just see if the borrower pays or not. So it could be a circumstance, could be swapping.
Something the committee may wish to interrogate, perhaps with the National Credit Regulator or some such other body. Thank you.
I think just to come in here that we are looking into the debt review process specifically. So we will, we haven't focused on that today because there's a lot already, but we will highlight some of the additional areas that we can come in and give feedback on. I think what's also important when looking at this slide is we're thinking about when does someone get to the point where they can't be rehabilitated. And so if you were to look along here, and I think the parts to, the colors to look at are the green ones, because the orange is can be misleading for its own reasons, particularly relating to the non-reporting of loans which are actually not, they're actually getting worse, but you know the credit provider has kind of given up and so they stop reporting on it. So what this means is that if you look at 6 months or plus, only 15% of those persons are actually rehabilitating. That's low compared to the 3 months where it's a third. So what we're also then needing to think from a policy perspective is across this credit journey and across from the point that someone is getting immediately gets into trouble, what help do they have? They're 3 months in arrears, what help do they have? They're 6 months, what help? And I think probably the level of intervention will have to increase depending on where they fit into this.
Just to add to that comment on that orange portion of the chart, so they remain the same. So as Kathy said, there is an issue in the Bureau where lenders, particularly when a loan hits 9 months, they stop updating it. So they just keep it at 9 months. So that affects us in a sense that we can't really analyze loans that are past 9 months. So you'll see going forward, that's kind of our maximum segment that we can look at. And it's also why when you look at these charts, at specifically the six months or more, it is a little unreliable there because it could just be loans where they're just not getting updated. But to add more complication to how borrowers do recover, it varies significantly depending on the type of account. So if you go down to slide 23, we're showing those exact same charts, so you can see again loans that were 1 month, 2 months, 3 months in arrears, what happened to them. But now we're looking at different account types. So we've got revolving accounts at the top, so you can see there's retail apparel accounts and credit cards, so revolving facilities, versus at the bottom we've got unsecured loans and retail furniture accounts, which are both term loans. And you can see that they vary very significantly. So if we look at retail apparel accounts, for example, if we look at the green sections, retail apparel accounts that were 3 months or more in arrears in June 2015, about 60% of them improved by June 2017. So it's a substantial portion improving. And likewise with credit cards, a substantial proportion of those loans were improving. Whereas when you look at the term loans, so if you look at the unsecured loans in the bottom left, once an unsecured loan hits 3 months, it's very unlikely to recover. So you can see just 10% of unsecured loans in that were 3 months or more in June 2015 had actually improved or recovered. So it varies a lot by the type of account. So we just wanted to look at what the value of loans in these different arrears categories is. So on the next slide, slide 24, we've got the value of outstanding debt. It's in billions of rands. And we're looking at just the value for those loans that are 3 months or more in arrears on the left in the dark blue, then 6 months, and then 9 months. So basically we're narrowing our focus as we go. So when we look at the 3 months, we've seen those numbers already. Unsecured credit from a bank around 6.5 billion, retail apparel around 5.1 billion. If you move across the 9 months or more in arrears, you can see that the total decreases. The totals are right at the bottom under the chart. So you can see that the total debt outstanding goes from around 20.7 billion on the 3 months or more up to about 13.2 on the 9 months or more. So that's a big difference. However, most of that difference comes from the retail, apparel, and other accounts.
There's no business getting these loans. You can't afford to put clothes on your back.
So the retail apparel, they decreased down to 1.8 billion when we only look at nine months or more in arrears. And the unsecured credit from a bank, though, that's still high at the 9 months or more. So that's still around 5.4 billion. We don't know, but some of this might be due to the debt of the African Bank bad book sitting there, so it might be doing something to our analysis. And much of that debt might also be prescribed, but we can't see further than 9 months. So that's the last sort of category we can actually look at.
So coming in just to, again, go on the theme of how badly are South Africans within the segment suffering, and to what extent are they going to be able to repay versus not being able to repay. I think what this is showing is that as we go from the 3 months to the 6 months to the 9 months, those, just a reminder that at 3 months, you might still be able to, there's more chance of you rehabilitating. As you go to 6 months, that drops off significantly. As you go to 9 months, it drops off again. So depending then on, so that's on the one lens. The other lens that we have is what is the impact. So if we look at those people, and I'm going to state this quite crudely, if we are concerned mostly with those people who are off the cliff, they're not going to rehabilitate, and I'm oversimplifying just to make the point, that would be the 9 months or more people, at the very least. Okay. So that's, and so that's the, it's important to look at that distribution. And if we look at that 9 months or more, that then is primarily currently bank debt, and it comes to the total of the 13 billion. If we then say, well, we actually think the 6 months or more is problematic, we need to be applying, that then obviously gets to a higher amount of 17 billion. If we look at anyone who's in arrears after 3 months, that's a much higher figure of 20 billion. So it's applying that lens of exactly who do you want to reach and why. And this gives you some sense of who will be of which entities would be impacted and how many borrowers would be impacted depending on how wide we cast the net.
So on that point of the loans that are 9 months or more in arrears, so we wanted to see if we take those loans that are 9 months or more in arrears and actually remove them, so pretend that they don't exist, what happens to our credit active market? So the next slide shows that same chart that we saw earlier. So that's exactly as we saw earlier. It's looking at those 9 million borrowers that fall into our segments. Of those with one loan, how many are in arrears, have loans that are 3 months or more in arrears, and of those with two or more credit products, how many are in arrears. And you see for the guys with one credit product only, about 63% are current, and for the borrowers with two or more credit products, 54% are current on all their loans, and then an additional 30% are current on some. So now if we said let's take those loans that are 9 months or more out the picture, this is what it would look like. So firstly, our number of borrowers would decrease from the 9 million total. We would actually only have 7.9 million credit active in this segment. And this is because there's around 1.1 million borrowers that fall away, because those borrowers only have loans that are 9 months or more in arrears. So if we take those loans away, then those borrowers technically are no longer visible in the credit market. You can see that it also, I can see, Chair, what we're trying to look at here is, what I described before is that if we look at the segment in terms of what we've defined of the earning less than $7,500, is that different borrowers in that segment are faring differently. Some are doing quite well, some are not doing well at all, some are doing really, really badly. So what we wanted to get a sense of is what would the quality of the of that market, of that segment look like if we took out what we see as being those who are off the cliff. They are the worst of the worst. Now, I don't mean that they're bad as borrowers. I mean that they are worse in terms of over-indebtedness, that we see that those people, we don't think that they're going to rehabilitate. And the reason why we're doing that is we're wanting to see whether the overall results, to what extent the overall results might be skewed because you've got a section of the population who are really, really suffering badly. So on the left, it includes all the borrowers, including those who are worst off. On the right, it's then saying we've taken off those who have their loans more than 9 months in arrears. We're wanting to see what would the quality or the health of the credit market look like under that scenario, and you'll see that it looks then a lot more healthy. So you will see and it's just going to show how much if we're looking at the overall health of this market, it goes from 63% to 77% healthy by taking out those who are suffering most, which are having the more than the 9 months. So again, this is a way to reflect impact in terms of how can we help the segment to get more healthy, who do we need to help the most? Thanks. Yeah, so the slide on the right just shows that if you do remove those loans, it improves quite significantly. So just to go back to our summary slide again to relook at what the numbers say. So total credit active markets down to borrowers that are eligible, that 9 million again. Number of borrowers with loans that are 3 months or more in arrears, which we saw earlier, 3.5 million. And those borrowers are in arrears on everything else. We go down to 2.6 million. So now we've added another level to say, let's look at borrowers with loans that are 9 months or more, and they're in arrears on all their other accounts. And now we're looking at around 1.5 million borrowers, so considerably fewer than our original 9.2 million. So those 1.5 million borrowers, they hold about 1.7 million loans, and the total outstanding balance on those loans is around 9.8 billion. So we've been looking at arrears status, but another consideration that we wanted to look at is the debt burden. So debt burden is just another way of saying installment to income ratio, and the calculation for debt burden is we just take the total debt payments for that borrower every month, and we divide it by their monthly income. And you end up with a ratio, and we've split it out. So, it's, for example, if you have a debt burden of around 10%, that means that 10% of your gross income is going towards debt repayments each month. So we calculated the debt burdens, and we had a look at how they change by income. So this slide shows the various borrower income groups. So you can see along the x-axis there at the bottom, our income groups ranging from less than 3,500 on the left, all the way up to borrowers who are earning 50,000 Rand or more. And then the colors in the chart is telling us the debt burden. So from the bottom, with that sort of blue color, that's very low debt burden, moving all the way up to a debt burden of over 70% is the black level, and the very last top segment there is debt burden of over 1. So that means that you're in more than your entire monthly income would have to go to debt repayments. So just to note again that this is on borrowers with no home loan. Which is important because if you look at the borrowers earning 50,000 or more, you'll see a lot of them have a very low debt burden. Obviously, if we put home loan in, that would change this. But what is interesting is that for lots of the lower and middle income group, the debt burden is quite stable. It doesn't actually change hugely. So if you look, so if we're interested, for example, in looking at people who are contributing around 30% of their income to debt payments, we'd be looking from that dark blue bar up. And what we see is that for a lot of those lower and middle income borrowers, they're contributing around 35% a third of borrowers are contributing in excess of 30% of their income to debt repayments. So I suppose the key question is just how much can borrowers afford, specifically lower income borrowers, where obviously a higher portion of your income needs to be going towards other expenses. So another key question we had was, does your debt burden influence your ability to pay? So how does it influence your arrears status? Do we see people with a higher debt burden struggling to pay? And the answer is we do see a definite relationship. So the next chart is quite busy again. So maybe I'll just explain the top chart first. So basically what we're doing here is we're looking at the borrower arrears status by different debt burdens. So on the bottom axis there, you can see borrowers with the different debt burdens from 0 to 0.1, so those are the borrowers that are contributing 10% or less to debt repayments, all the way up to, on the right-hand side, borrowers that are contributing 100% or more of their gross income to debt payments. So this is borrowers with one account only, and you can see that the green portion of the chart means that they're current on that account, and the red portion means that they're in arrears of 3 months or more. And you can see a definite relationship. As the debt burden increases, the proportion of borrowers that have that one loan that they have as current decreases. So we also did the same for borrowers with two or more loans. And again, you can see that relationship. If we look right on the left there, the borrowers with a debt burden of 10% or less that have two or more open accounts, 72% of them were current on all those accounts, and 11% were in arrears on all of them. If we look to the other end of the scale, just 37% of borrowers with a debt burden of one or more were current on all those accounts. What is interesting about this chart is that even as debt burdens increase, you see quite a large portion of borrowers sitting in the yellow and orange segments. So those, again, are those borrowers that are in arrears on some loans but are current on others. So that just shows that many highly indebted consumers are still paying something. So even if they're not paying all their accounts, they are managing to pay something. So the last slide, just a summary. So the first point is it's critical to understand borrower incomes. So we have some indications, but these need to be verified. The second point is it's critical to understand collectible debt. So again, we have some indications, but these need to be engaged with. On the third point, it's critical to understand the ability as opposed to willingness to pay, and to identify those who cannot pay. So we have some indication of this, so borrowers who aren't paying anything versus borrowers who are able to pay something. But for those borrowers that are struggling but not over the cliff, what process exists for them? And then the last point, it's just useful to think carefully about how this intervention will be assessed going forward, and what are the key indicators we hope will shift by through this intervention.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I know that's been a lot to digest. So that is the first part, which is the strictly the data story. We now have a presentation around what does this mean, or what can we read from it. I'm just wondering if we would have, we were planning to do this today, but I think it will probably take me, well, I can try and do it in 10 minutes, but that would still only leave 15 minutes. So I just want to check with you, would you rather I continue with my presentation immediately, or should we be taking questions on the data specifically? I mean, the alternative is that I can maybe just give you a 2 minutes, 3 minutes summary of where we think this is going, and then we can circulate the presentation with more detail afterwards.
Now, I think you should just give us that brief overview, because I do wish you to go to the subcommittee as well, so that you'll be able to go into greater detail. But give us this short overview from yourself.
Okay. So I think the impact, as it were, really will come down to how we ultimately define those parameters. And what you've seen is that there could be a massive difference between the 9.8 billion debt written off to the extent that we apply those people who have gone off the cliff, as it were, the 9 months or more, up to the, I think it's more than 50 billion if we apply the current parameters. Our sense from this is that what's coming out from the data is that there are a lot of people within this category of people, or within this category as we've defined, that are making payments and that they can pay. So firstly, there's a lot. In fact, most of them are actually paying, and are paying routinely, and are in good standing. There's a category in between, which is struggling, but they're making some payments. And then there are some South Africans within this category who are not paying, and it's unlikely that they will be able to pay. And so the question for us is, if we think about that in terms of this, that's how the market is operating, we take a step back and what are we trying to resolve? What is the problem here? And what we highlighted in the previous previous session was that actually this is an insolvency problem. It's largely an insolvency problem, a sequestration problem, and it's a debt review problem. So a lot of those people, there's the green people, which are, they're completely healthy. We don't need to help them. They're actually doing okay. Then there are the oranges, if we can call it that, who are somewhat doing okay, but they're struggling. And we think that there are existing mechanisms which we should be leveraging in order to help those people, which is currently what's been proposed is the debt review system. We know that there are weaknesses there, but what we're considering is how we could better use the debt review system to help those people who can be paying, they can be rehabilitated, but currently they can't actually access the debt review system, or it's not working for them for whatever reason. We think we should look at that. Then there are those people who we don't think can be rehabilitated. And what we mean by that is it's not that we're saying they can't ever be rehabilitated, it's that we think that they are, in effect, they're insolvent. And that's what the international work that's been referenced is trying to provide for those people who they can't rehabilitate through the current mechanisms. So we would like to, and this is what we had spoken about in the previous session as well, is to be exploring, rather than having the once-off, provide for an ongoing intervention, as it were, that would, for those people that are the red, the off the cliff, that can't, we're not going to help, they're not going to be helped through debt review. They don't have, they're not going to, they can't make good on their loans, they're not going to make good on their loans because they've lost their job or some other economic event has happened, or they are just chronically over indebted because they've got too many loans relative to how much they do earn. We think that the bill, the current version of the bill, can be tweaked with relatively light surgery to actually be extended to be applied on an ongoing basis to help those people. So broadly speaking, that's where some of our more of the policy thinking, and we think the policy debate can move to. But I think the focus of today really was on the data and what the data is showing. I wanted to just give a high-level reflection on how we're thinking about this, because that obviously then also does interpret how you can be looking at the data and the findings within the data.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibson, Ms. Meltzer, Ms. Hayworth, and Mr. Ordendahl is just at the back there. All right, members, it's really been, I think, a very constructive a study, and 300,000 was the sample. It's a huge number. Let us have your questions, please. Honourable MacPherson. Only Honourable MacPherson, by the looks of things. Honourable Tlanguini. Oh yes, Honourable Buyani. Thank you. In that order. And this is an important piece of work. Take a couple of minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gibson and your team. I think from the outset, this is, what we had asked for all that time ago, because I think that you define the question very clearly, that it's important to know who you're speaking to or what are the category of people that you're looking at. And I think that this, and it's through no fault of your own, would have been exceptionally helpful before we went along this process, because I mean, I think that the proposed bill misses a lot of what you found in here. And I mean, we're talking about some pretty big numbers, 50 billion, 9 million people, and immediately what comes to mind is who adjudicates millions of applications. Is it the one person at the NCT? And I think you've given a whole lot of people at the NCT heart palpitations as to how they're going to adjudicate millions of applications that are going to come through. But I think on your slide 16, that is the real clearest picture of how of how misguided our approach, and I speak just personally, has been to this, because it would completely undermine the credit market to take that 59% of consumers out for up to 36 months when they can effectively pay and make some contribution. And I just wanted to understand what is the number or the monetary value of that 59% in terms of loans that they hold, and if you have that. The one thing that did concern me, and I think it reinforces the narrative that there's a huge problem with debt review and it's not achieving what it was envisaged to do so. And I think that is well articulated on slide 19 when you, in your bubble, indicate that 80% of those those loans in debt recovery actually don't succeed. And for me, that speaks to what this whole process should actually be looking at, is how do you identify those that can never and will never qualify for debt review, and how do you actually make debt review more affordable and more streamlined to do a job. Now, I would think, and I'm speaking off the top of my head, and I hope my own bank doesn't close my account down for saying this, but surely it would make sense for credit providers to rather look at subsidizing or assisting in the debt review process than seeing those large amounts of loans removed. Has National Treasury done anything around about what an alternative debt review process could look like and what that would actually cost? And then to page, or I think it's one of your last slides, the two comparative pie charts with the 1.14 million borrowers taken away. I somewhat disagree with that, because the fact of the matter is that those people will re-enter that same space after 36 months. So, you know, you can change the numbers and change the colors, but the strong likelihood, and we know that there's a strong likelihood, that those consumers will re-enter that space once again, and in fact you will fall back to the 9 million borrowers. You know, it would just be staggered over time. So I just want to understand why you thought it was good to put those two charts together. And then on your last in summary, I think that your point three for me is the one that really, you know, gives us a lot, you know, to think about understanding ability versus willingness, because who wants to pay their debt back? I would love not to. You know, if there's one, you know, must fall campaign I would subscribe to, it would be debt must fall. I would probably want to be one of the leaders of that. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I have an obligation to do so. And that is the real crux of the matter of ability versus willingness. And I think that we've got a lot in terms of applying our mind to doing that, because what we can't do, and I'd like your view on this, how do we extinguish debt that has been granted in terms of the legal prescripts and then do so retrospectively? I think it's one of the key questions that we haven't answered as a committee, because if you have done so in terms of legislation, how do we then enact legislation that says something that was done legally, now retrospectively, is now extinguished? So just your thoughts on that, but I'd like to commend you on the work done so far.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Slanguini.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. There's quite a lot of points, Chair, that we need to peruse through point by point as the subcommittee and the committee on some of the issues that have the research have based on. For me, on page 16, I just like to understand that pie chart again. On the 59% that can pay, how are we assured that, yes, they can pay, but they still be able to live beyond or, you know, sustain their livelihood? Yes, you can be a good payer of your debt, but are you surviving through the months? Are you, you know, aren't you strained and stuff like that? So how do we know that those people are not strained, because some can, because of various phone calls, feel threatened and just, you know, go and pay and use their last monies.
On the one of the, you know, Chair, I'm very concerned about the figures that are being raised. For me, it's somehow.
Could you just hold on a minute, Honourable Tlangwini? There is 16, but it's not our 16. I'm just trying to.
It's slide 16, not page 16.
Well, ours are slides as well here. So far, we've done pretty well. Okay. I see you've got two page 16s, slide 16s, right.
Okay.
But of course one was not quite prepared for that. Right, yeah. Do go ahead, Honourable.
On the figures, Chair, I think it's being very alarmistic, like to just throw figures on it. You know, when we were like in the craft of drafting this bill, we have clear indications who do we want to seek to address in this bill. And it's fine and good to throw figures, you know, you're going to write off 50 billion or 16 billion and so forth. But I think it's being alarmist to raise that now in this process. And it shouldn't stop our work in any way or form of what we seek to achieve in this bill. What is a few 10 billion to some companies that are anyway recklessly lending to our people on grants and so forth? So we shouldn't be alarmist on that. And on the debt review system, I don't feel convinced that thing is helping our communities. I don't feel by any chance. And I think we shouldn't advocate for that debt review, because sometimes you have even, when we have found it, that you get unqualified people giving people advice on debt, you know. So I am really not convinced at this stage that debt review process is assisting us. But I stand to be proven wrong, but I don't think that it's assisting us. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Tlangwini, Honourable Kacharya, followed by, but you said no or yes, I wasn't too sure, Yania, and then Honourable Mantash, yes.
Thank you. Thanks for a very good presentation. I was not here for part of it, but I caught the gist of it at the end. I think I'd just like to make 3 points in that even if you halve the numbers, it's still a very significant number. So let's understand that the impact is not insignificant here. And it certainly won't be a halving of the numbers. In our previous deliberations in the last week, it was fairly unanimous from the credit providers that they would be willing to come to the party in terms of debt review payment and to assist in that regard. And I think that's an area that we should push and investigate, because it's useful and responsible. And when someone's being responsible, perhaps over and above the call of duty, but in their interest, we must take advantage of it. And then thirdly, yes, just to reiterate that assuming responsible lending and cutting out irresponsible, reckless lending, it's a time-honored principle in this industry to differentiate between can't pay and won't pay, and that absolutely has to be done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kacharya. It should actually be Honourable Buyani, followed by Honourable Mantash. My apologies to you.
No, apology accepted, Chair. Thanks very much, Chair. Let me also acknowledge and welcome the presentation. Very much insightful. It giving us a clear understanding as to what is happening outside there. But also, Chair, I wanted to check, man, in terms of their findings. What caused the highest percentage on the banks, not the other credit providers? On the banks, yes, because it's the highest in terms, 48% or so. So rather the other service providers. And also, I'm not so sure, because we have a lot of page 19s here. And Chairman, What is your view in terms of the aggressive campaigning vis-a-vis the highest percentage that we have here, through the credit provider banks specifically? And also to check from the National Treasurer, maybe they can make recommendation on how the committee through the bill can ensure that its target, the people in distress, rather the figures that we are getting here, and, it's confusing us, which is the 29% really that we're looking for. That is, it's in red. Thanks very much.
Honourable Buyani, Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. We appreciate the information supplied by 18 to 18, 20, 18, 20, whatever. But we find comfort, Chairperson, that the submission is going to be taken to the subcommittee. And I just hope that this is in no way trying to dilute our energy to ensure that bill sees the dawn as this committee, Chairperson, because we're standing for those people that have no voice out there. And they don't even know the figures that are presented here. But they've been, you know, victimized by unscrupulous lenders. And that's where we're going for. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mantash. I have a couple of questions myself. With respect to the 80-20, you know what, when I looked at this, and it was many, many slides, which referred to retail apparel, and I actually made a comment. My comment is not, do you need the basic items? My comment is what I see being bought. And this is clothing that I would call, if you don't have the money, then leave it. You see, you don't have the money. Nice to have, but I can't afford it. But it is amazing, and somewhere along here, I think it is National Treasury, also refers, how are the affordability processes being conducted by these retail organizations? I can tell you, I've come across young relatives, students, who tell me, oh, you know, I've got X and Y, and they're giving me this. I said, well, have you told them what you earn? You're on a loan. You're on, actually, your poor single mother is doing this. I mean, are they aware of your... Yeah, but they said it's customized for students. What utter rubbish. And these are reputable companies. They're not fly-by-nights. They're even in all the malls. Have a look yourself on a Saturday morning. See who's there on a Sunday and some weekdays. I don't know how the students are studying, but they are definitely studying the retail market for clothing. So, and it isn't just clothing apparel. In that same area comes makeup. The amount of money I buy at Clicks. I can't afford some of this nonsense. And I don't think I look too bad on that. But the point is, it's very costly. I think if you've got the money, but not students, this is really the limit. And for that matter, domestic workers in the house, for the most part, they're not earning 250 rand a day. I can tell you that, because most people think I am far too good. I'm just paying a living wage. And they're earning under 180 a day, probably 100 or something, for 3 days' work a week. And reputable companies are giving them these loans, and then, of course, they get into challenges. What is their income? You see? So I'm really concerned about the retail apparel, very concerned. Furniture's doing a lot better, it would appear. You know, I say from the retail apparel, if you look at your figures, I'm not comparing it to anything else because I know we have a problem with that and what they're paying. the unsecured credit. I'm glad the question was raised. I think it was by yourself, Honourable Buyani. But having said that, the principle which was raised by the Ms. Gibson as well from Treasury about, look, if you can pay, and in fact one of our own members here raised and re-emphasized that point, you know, if you can, then you should. It should not be whether you're willing. And yes, I think that is an important point that we should look into as well. But the other one is the non-recoverable loans, yes. The point about debt recovery has already been raised. But on this page, or slide 30, the debt burden, there's a further consideration as the debt burden, the monthly debt. While lenders report expected installments to bureaus, bureau estimates of income are typically unreliable. I don't know if some of you picked that one up at all. And the last one here, which has already been referred to, this page about borrower incomes, the collectible debt. Yes, I think we do need to get a better understanding of that. And I do believe, though, that Ms. Gibson, you and the team will be, I hope, spending a little bit more time with the subcommittee and going into greater detail on this matter. There was one interesting point, and I don't know, I'm taking this out of context, but it's from yourself, Ms. Gibson, or certainly the presentation you put forward. And you didn't say this, but it's in the presentation. Have observed large variation in results between 80-20 study and BASA. Nonetheless, the impact is sizable. The question is just how much. And I think the point was made by the Honourable Kachali about, well, look, let's just look at, you know, the significance and the impact. The other one was the systemic risk impact raised by yourself, Ms. Gibson, and the wider economic. You did go into a fair amount of that in detail, but the NINAs, the reference here, do we want to extinguish this debt? And I think there was some explanation of perhaps if we reduced it to this group or that group and targeted things differently, and also who can be rehabilitated, etc. But do we want to, and what is the likely impact? And this is something I happen to know that Honourable Williams, as the chair of that subcommittee, kept on repeating the importance of a savings culture. We do not want a negative impact on the credit culture. This is already in bad shape in our country. And not from the 7,500, you noted the 50,000 people. Very, very disturbing. So we wouldn't want to impact negatively in that area. So if you could seize these comments and questions and respond accordingly. If you wish to go into greater detail in writing, you may do so.
Thank you, Chair, and I'll rely on the data team as well, the technical team. I think the biggest issue for us is this principle, at least to think about, is do we treat this category all the same or don't we? In terms of and differentiating between the can you pay, should you pay, and this does go to the heart of the matter, because what we are looking for, and there was a question, there was a point made about whether we're wanting to dilute the results or dilute the impact, and the question is not about diluting the impact, it's about finding a way to sustainably solve what we see as current weaknesses in the credit market and potentially the regulatory environment around it. And so initially, I mean, just to take us back, we had initially, where we had got the 7,500 income from was to say that actually the current mechanisms
we can have a discussion around whether debt review is working best or not. Are people still suffering? Aren't they? Is it accessible? Isn't it? But what we saw is that there's a point where debt review actually just isn't accessible at all. And that's where we started with the 7,500. We can also have some discussion around, is it 7,500, is it 7,000, is it 6,000, is it 10,000? But the point being is that there is a point where it's not currently accessible. But I think what is important is that I would hazard to say that the majority of borrowers do not actually want, yes, you want to get your debt written off or extinguished, but actually you don't want the consequences that come attached to that. You actually don't want to be excluded from the credit market. So if we think very realistically, if you're extinguished, if your debt is extinguished, you are going to be excluded from the credit market for a period of however many years. That's the consequence. So what we're framing is the question, do we want to then actually be deliberately excluding those people from the market who don't actually need to be excluded? Because actually the problem is not that they can't pay, the problem is that the rehabilitation mechanisms just don't work for them currently. So what we are thinking about is for those people who are in between, there's the people who are, they're making their payments, there are the people who absolutely will not be able to make their payments. For those in between, can we think more creatively about how to still rehabilitate those people, but in a way where it's not so extreme as the extinguishing of debt and the scenarios as it plays out? I think there was a very important question raised around the how do we know that 59%, just because you're making good on your payments, doesn't mean you're actually not under severe strain? And I don't have a short answer for that. I think it's something which we need to think about. What we can say is that you are not so much under strain that you are forfeiting some or at least some of your payments. I mean, my sense would be, just intuitively, is that if your family is that significantly under strain, at the very least, you are going to be liquidity managing, and you are going to let some loans go. I mean, off the record. So I think it's a fair. I think it is a fair indicator, but it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile thinking about. And then there's more. There were some more detailed questions around if we take out the. We're looking at the health of the credit market, and if we take out the chunk, the what we see as the red, will they ultimately come back and be red again? Our sense is that the regulatory environment has improved significantly from where it was when these people initially got themselves into trouble. Our hope, at least, would be that the strengthening of the regulatory environment is such that it is far less easy to get those, even if loans were not necessarily, even if they were not recklessly in terms of the law. They were reckless in terms of a person's financial health and ultimately proved detrimental. This is something, however, that would need to be tracked very, very closely. I think it would be of even more significant concern if what we are saying is that a person who is rehabilitated today and who enters the credit market, even with the protections, is actually not protected, because that means our regulatory environment is failing. The related question here around debt review and the role of debt review is such that I think we need to be careful around not acknowledging the role that debt review can play. Because what we have is a mechanism which, for whatever its shortcomings, does provide a lifeline. It might not work best, it might be expensive, there are shortcomings. But if to the extent that there are those shortcomings, in principle, it's a good thing. The question then is, how do we fix the shortcomings? I mean, even to take an example of, I think that the DCRS system has been improved dramatically.
And what that actually means is that I think we could probably get to a point, even if we're thinking about debt extinguishing, a debt extinguishing scenario, we could even get to the point where we actually just leverage off that system and no subjective decision making is even necessary. If we say, for example, please, these are not proposals, they're just hypotheticals. If we were to say that if you are earning less than $7,500 and you have less than your 50,000 rand debt, we have an algorithm and your income is X. We have, and your debt obligations are Y. We have an algorithm which would, based on that, be able to calculate, can you actually afford this debt or can't you? It would then just go into the computer, it would come out and say, we think you can, but your repayments need to be X. And we think you can because we've put into the computer, the system, that we think you need 60% of your, we think you need 40% of your income in order to survive, and working back from that, this is what we think you can pay. It can also come out, well, actually, we don't think you can pay, and therefore, we need to extinguish your debt. It's a highly oversimplified version of it. But I think that for this to be practical, we need to think that there firstly is a spectrum here, but though that spectrum can in fact have defined parameters, and probably a lot of it can be done electronically and through digital, and that would take a lot of the subjectivity and the complication, the complexity out. There was a question around the extinguishing of debt retrospectively. Yes, I think that this is from a constant. This has been flagged, I think, a related issue, which is on some of the constitutional challenges of the proposals in the current form. I think retrospectivity is one of the issues which is coming up. So I think it's worth engaging on. Then, just checking that I've responded. I think there were a couple of questions related to 80-20 on the data side, so perhaps you can come in on those. The one was on the 59% of the credit market and what exactly the values there. There was a question related to the retail apparel. There was also a question around the highest numbers coming through on the bank side. And then the income data in general, the chair had made a point.
Okay. I'm just going to comment on some of them. I think in particular the question about why so much of the debt that's held by this distressed base of borrowers in the sort of target market is bank debt. When we looked at that, it looks like a lot of that is very old. So those arrears are very, very old arrears. And it was a question that we can't answer, but we think it's worth interrogating as to how much of that is the bad bank. And that we think, again, it's interesting to just deconstruct this debt, and I think speaks to the question about, you know, we're not kind of glibly saying anything 9 months or more should be chucked out. Ideally, we would have loved to have an estimate of what is prescribed, but we can't see that because that's 36 months and lenders are not reporting. So I think it's giving us a sense of some of the debt that might be there has a very long hangover. You know, it kind of sticks around and hangs around for a hell of a long time, and maybe that is the first place we look, how much of that really is collectible, how much of that do institutions really plan on collecting themselves. So I think that speaks to the point about the bank. We think that it's worth investigating more. We can't with the data that we have and with the permissions that we have at this stage, but it's worth looking at. On the question of the 59%, I mean, that's about 2.7 million loans of the 4.7, so that's it's a fair amount. Again, I think that speaks to the point of, you know, the people paying that. Are they actually able to pay that, or are they just giving up on so many other things? I don't know, Claire, if there are other things that you want to comment on.
It sounds like you certainly have addressed these issues, but you yourself know that there are areas you may have wanted to flesh out in greater detail, but as Ms. Gibson also points out, we will be engaging again. The door has been opened. This is a very important report. So anything you feel will assist us in a written expansion, please do so. And what I have been asked by the chairperson of the subcommittee, the Honourable Williams, is he's requesting the DOJ, Ms. Pillay, National Treasury, plus 8020, to please meet with the subcommittee on Friday, no, not this Friday, Friday the 2nd of March, 8:30 to 11:30, 12. So, you know, you can obviously try and get on those early afternoon flights on a Friday. But I'm reminding the members of the subcommittee, this is a very important process. And you've been identified, Honourable Kachalia, by DA as someone who, is that copyright? And debt, is that yourself, Honourable MacPherson? Yes, and you have kept a weather eye on things, thank you. You know, yeah. And Honourable Tlanguini, also. Honourable Mantash, and Honourable Buyani, you'll have to sort out that Limpopo's flight, you know. No, he was not. So those of you who were not concentrating, I have put him there as the others are on other committee, subcommittees. So, he is there, and there he will remain, because I know he wants to participate more actively, as he indicated to me. And this would certainly be a very good start. You know, and you've shown your interest in the questions and comments. You were interested in what the pertinent questions you asked about the bank and this and that. It shows where your interests lie, yes. So, and I think that's important for us to have some male support for the Honourable Williams. Yeah. Anyway, that is what we're up to. It is 2 o'clock tomorrow. Where? Where is the meeting? E249, 2 o'clock, sharp, and we've made arrangements for transport. I hope none of you were spending Valentine's Day before 7 with your partners. Isn't it Valentine's Day?
I thought you were taking us out for dinner tomorrow night.
Well, yes, I wanted to, but I haven't had a chance to send my cards. Okay. You're all my Valentines. You're very dear to me, the whole committee. Yeah, thank you to your being here early and applying your minds, all of you. Thank you very much. To visitors and those who made presentations, thank you. And once again, thank you to people like the National Consumer Tribunal, the National Credit Regulator, DTI, Treasury, who is here religiously. Thank you. And thank you to Advocate van der Merwe, another religious devotee here, and Ms. Naidu. Now, thank you to all of you. Ms. Meltzer, for the record, was the last person to speak from 8020, and it was, is that right? You are Ms. Meltzer. I thought you were saying you're no longer Miss Melcy. You got me worried. Now, especially with Valentine's Day here now. But Ms. Hayworth, thank you for the presentation. But remember, I don't know who told you we are Caltrain. We're not. Thank you. Meeting adjourned till tomorrow at 2 in E249. Thank you.